Number 3, political control. The government plan to appoint Ofcom as their new online speech regulator. Ofcom will be given the powers to punish platforms who don't police their sites strictly enough. But the government have given themselves powers to influence Ofcom and set the standards for what should and shouldn't be allowed on the web.
It's Friday, it's 1 minute past 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 10th of February 2023, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, which, if you're ever in the city, do poke your nose in here. If it's during the daytime or a Saturday, the China shop is open around the corner. Lots and lots of China is produced here, of all sorts, from the mild to the extreme, shall we say, Bristolian slang, and a little bit of swearing as well sometimes, but it's a terrific little production house for China, as well as all sorts of other arts that go on here, particularly at the space, the People's Comedy. We were, as we walked out last Friday, right into the middle of the crowd from that very thriving arts centre, and that is at prsc.org.uk. if you're online, if you're in Bristol, come on down. And we're also on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything but Google. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its psychological warfare propaganda, smearing cheap COVID treatment, as Tess Laurie told us. The TV lied, and an estimated 60,000 Brits died. An unhappy bunch of death trip deep state losers. That's Sio-Nazi hero Zelensky's been over here this week on a hiding to nothing, waging war on the British people now, as well as Putin. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Part one this week, the 5G court case on Monday and Tuesday. Robert Hanson, barrister, was there. He's a guy who's come over here. He's now having thoughts about going back to Hong Kong after the Chinese completely stopped all their COVID restrictions, and having a bit of a rough time here. But he thought, maybe it's time to go back to Hong Kong. And also, we've got Right to Roam campaigner Jonathan Moses, and he's a bit of a lawyer too. He's been researching all of the law around the right to trespass. What are our rights? And this, of course, is going to be featuring next year in the general election, most probably, with the Labour Party looking like they're going to be picking up much of the Right to Roam agenda. In part two, guess what? Well, yes, it's Zelensky in Westminster Hall, Big Brother style. And then Scott Ritter on the tanks, and now the fighter jets, but also Scott Ritter on Zelensky. A special this week, Hilda Morell, UK World War II deep state actor. She was, I'm talking about Hilda, this rose grower who was killed over the Sizewell B inquiry back in the 1980s. Well, it turns out she was a part of the deep state. UK here in World War II. No wonder people were afraid of her. I have a chat to Rob Green and Kate Dews. Rob is her nephew, author of A Thorn in Their Side, and this full interview will be up later tonight at thisweek.org.uk, and also a rare video interview up on BitChute and YouTube later tonight as well. But also, Rob takes a good old look at nuclear power today. And it's interesting, particularly, I think, because he, in the beginning of the 1980s, the decade of the big expansion of the AGR, advanced gas cooled reactors, here in the UK, like Sizewell B, he was a Royal Navy intelligence officer. So he'll be on Conspiracy Classics, a new one. For anyone that wants to suggest a conspiracy classic, do feel free. They're all up on Radio 4 All in a big in order there, with a little introduction to each one. And we did them beginning of last year, but I've got a new one now. And it's from number 13 on central bank digital currencies, discussed back in 2009. I think they did pretty well, and you'll be hearing a bit of that later. The latest in our series of Mark Purdy on organophosphates, is about 10 of those to go through altogether, so we'll be chugging through those up until the spring probably. And here this week he talks about organophosphate pesticides in the food chain. And a transhumanist, to round up, a transhumanist New Year's Eve firework display sidelined by the drones. So the drones kind of stole the stage. But what sigils, this is the word that we were introduced to last week, are in there, in these displays. Fascinating, I think. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel, and then a week or so later by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. Martin, let's begin, I think, with the 5G. What are your thoughts about this? If you had a big 5G mast suddenly appear outside your house 150 feet high, would you be bothered?
Well, it's not my area of expertise, if you like, and I tend to listen to arguments about it. I'm willing to listen to arguments about how it may cause problems, because we know, for example, that radar in World War II, it was kept secret that it caused major problems for the people who were operating.
Funnily enough, that's also microwaves, isn't it?
Yes, yes, and much bigger, more dangerous microwaves than the ones we're talking about. But of course, because radar was so important to the war effort, nobody bothered to tell the people who were using it. And you can say that's justified or not. But, I mean, that's the way my mind works about all of these kinds of things. Don't presume you know what's going on.
No. And particularly if your body starts heating up next to a 5G mast. So, anyway, Robert Hansen is a sort of regular on and off on this programme from Hong Kong, now actually over in East Anglia. He's staying over there. He had enough of Hong Kong, but he's now thinking about going back. But anyway, that's not why he's on to talk about, although in the longer interview he does talk about that. Let's have a listen to him now, because he was there Monday and Tuesday this week in the High Court to hear the hearing all about 5G, with Michael Mansfield putting the case against it.
It was. I enjoyed the atmosphere. I went down for both days. Outside the court, there were a number of people holding banners in protect us from 5G, stop 5G. And inside the courtroom, I think it's court number 73 at the Royal Courts of Justice, there were probably over 100 people crammed in there. All seats absolutely taken, people sitting on the floor, extra chairs were brought in. It was like a horseshoe shape, crowded around the barristers and right up to the judge. It was really, really packed out. People behaved themselves very, very well. And when the counsel for the government had the nerve to say there is no duty to provide information, the whole courtroom just burst into laughter. And the judge was, order, order, if you can't do this, you must behave yourselves, because you've got to give him a chance to make his point. But one aspect of concern for me was when Lady Stacey, Mary Stacey, made the comment about this no requirement to provide information. She referenced Andrew Wakefield, and she said, we don't want to bring about an Andrew Wakefield situation, which kind of suggests she's probably more on the we trust the government rather than anybody else that goes against the government wavelength. So I'm not 100% confident this is going to go in favour of people opposing or wanting information about 5G being made mandatory, so the government has to give people information about the risks.
What about after the case? Did you manage to sort of retire to a nearby hostelry?
We did. Quite a lot of us went. I had a good chat with Michael Mansfield as well after the case, just a general talk with him. I met some other barristers that I'd known for a long time, very senior barristers, also King's Counsel. Had a good talk with them, and again, brief discussion about what was happening. Their view was, and kind of off the record, so I'm not going to give their names, but it's very real and other people heard it, was that when you've got a government policy, it's unlikely the judge is going to go against it. So that's partly why I'm not too optimistic. But yes, a lot of us did go to the local pub, the George pub opposite, and we had a good discussion for about 4 or 5 hours. And it was very refreshing to talk with people that also had concerns, because you don't always meet them. And yeah, it was a very enjoyable experience.
Well, there is something sort of perverse and surreal, almost absurd, about the idea that the government is just simply there to defend an industry which is potentially causing enormous harm, and it's left to ordinary citizens, like a bunch of people from Chiswick, to try and face them down in court. I mean, it's surely the government, the government departments, the people we pay their wages and taxes, they should be the arbiters here, between the people and the industry, not actually taking one side entirely.
It is. You're absolutely right. But it's the worst thing, but another bad thing about this is that the people bringing the case had to raise 250,000 British pounds to pay for the case. And a lot of the money was used actually to try to even get this to court, because the government blocked, would keep on blocking the case from even reaching the court. And they had to go to the Court of Appeal to get the Court of Appeal to approve even this hearing. So it absorbs a lot of private money, a lot of individuals' money, but yet when the government's defending this, it's the taxpayer that's paying for it.
So Robert Hanson there, it was in the court on Monday and Tuesday, Martin. I mean, I think we've got to address this business, haven't we, that the government should be there as a kind of fair arbiter between the industry and the public. It doesn't seem to be that at all. It just seems to be taking up the cause of the telecoms industry that want to install these masts everywhere.
Yeah, well, what the argument is, and I'm not saying I agree with this, I'm just playing devil's advocate, if you like, is that the British way is to not regulate unless there's a reason to regulate. That basically there is always a presumption in favour of new developments on technology and industry, and that unless you can show that there's a palpable harm, we just presume it's okay. But that is not the case in the EU, where they have the precautionary principle.
Well, actually, all these 5G masts were approved while we were still in the EU.
I know, but the EU is also under heavy manners from the industry. The idea that it's that much better is wrong.
I mean, it's the same, isn't it?
The industry tends to dominate the judicial and political
process. It's
not
just that. Industry dominates the research. So when it comes to research on whether this stuff is dangerous, new technology is dangerous for you, it's the industry that pays for that research. Universities, as we saw with the case of aluminium and Chris Exley, as soon as an individual university starts to take a line which doesn't align with the funders of the university, then professors, in fact, whole departments can be shut down.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it works. That's the real world, and that's been undoubtedly the judge in this case will say, well, come on, folks, that's the real world. The counter-argument to doing that is you could have it all developed in the public sector, in which case there is no, you know, you're going to take account of, in theory, public health issues when you're developing the technology. But of course that can also lead to a situation where the government's invested loads of money in something, and having invested loads of money in stuff, I think they don't want it not to go ahead.
No, they don't.
So
no.
I mean, this is I mean,
let's just think for a minute, and I discussed this a little bit with Robert in the longer interview, which is be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, which is that the government also licenses these frequencies and collects a tremendous amount of money from the licenses, a bit like they might franchise out oil concessions or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the question is, I think this discussion has been conducted on the right level. I do not know how dangerous or not dangerous this stuff is, and I'm willing to listen to arguments about it. But what I will say is this, taking the argument in a slightly different direction, 5G is crucial to modern networked warfare. And that's why the Chinese have been pushed out of the 5G market by the Western powers. They don't want them in there. Huawei have been kicked out and all the rest of it. That's because, and China is racing ahead with this, and both sides are racing ahead with it because they see it as key to the coming confrontation.
Well, it does give a sort of a kind of pat on the back, maybe, to people who are saying, actually, what's being planned are these kind of dense mega cities where everyone will be forced to inhabit in there. Rather than, and they have to move out the countryside, have nothing to do or very little to do with the countryside. Maybe the countryside will just become the preserve of wildlife and the super rich.
Yeah, but I mean, that's,
but in fact, around London, it already is becoming like
all right.
That.
Well, I mean, let's just think about the situation in China, because I mentioned China. The population of China is about 50% urban now, so they've still got 50% of the population living in rural areas. That, in fact, means that they could either upgrade things in rural areas, is what they're trying to do. They're trying to get more investment into the western part of China, the inner area of China, because most of the developed area of China is on the east coast. Yeah. Now, all of that, you know, they're trying to leap ahead of western high tech, which is all this stuff about the chip factory in Taiwan. And the Americans are now moving part of that to Arizona. What's happening now is all of this high-tech stuff is being divvied up in preparation for a showdown. and you don't want a Chinese chip in your rocket, do you? And the Chinese don't want an American chip in their rocket. And that's why you've got to develop your own 5G if you're going to win the battle that these people all perceive themselves to be in. And I mentioned radar at the beginning of this discussion. If you were a planner in the US Pentagon or the Chinese military, and it turned out this stuff was a bit dangerous, it's a bit like radar in World War II. It may be dangerous, but we want it.
Possibly. In parallel with the 5G discussion, we've also got there's been a big discussion in science about the dangers or not of the COVID jabs, and generally the COVID protocols, because just like the tankers that are chugging around with cheap Russian oil in, the Western insurance companies, Martin, are refusing to insure them because the oil in that tanker was bought at too low a price. I just find the financial services industry seem to be kind of going beyond their remit. You would have thought, actually, that because that was cheaper oil, the insurance company would be happier to insure it, because if whatever happened, it wouldn't have to pay the higher price for the oil if the oil was lost.
Well, I think that what this shows is that there isn't a global power able to enforce its rules. There is, in fact, competition between various power centres. Whatever you may think of those powers. And of course, they've all got things in common. You know, these things are in competition with each other. And by being in competition with each other, they develop similar features. But that's, you know, there will be some Western dodgy insurance companies who are quite happy to get involved, no doubt. And the Russians will know who they are. Yeah. There's all sorts of dodgy stuff goes on. And
we shall be talking about the dodgy stuff. In part two, that particular type of dodgy stuff, and I'm sure you know what we mean, Seymour Hersh's article this week, but Dr. Vernon Coleman, he's been going right throughout the pandemic, and for many years before. There's even footage of him back in the early 1980s, talking on local TV about how the pharmaceutical industry must be reined in. I mean, he's been absolutely banging away at this for ages, but he's also really concerned about what's going on in our hospitals. And incentives there are to get people out of beds, to free up beds. So this is actually from nearly a month ago, but I just came across, I thought it's a very powerful argument he's putting here. So let's have a listen to an extract from one of Dr. Vernon Coleman's recent videos, The Old Man in a Chair.
I'm going to start by telling you about a woman in her early 70s whose story is significant, to say the least. She'd been in good health when suddenly, unexpectedly, she collapsed, and after the now customary 8-hour wait for an ambulance, eventually found herself in hospital. She was unconscious, and a junior doctor eventually diagnosed that she'd had a stroke. It wasn't a difficult diagnosis, it was what her husband, her son, and the paramedics had all diagnosed. Eventually they found a bed for her, and the doctors confessed that there wasn't much they could do. How long will it be before we know anything? Asked the woman's husband. She could be like this for days, for weeks, or for months, replied the doctor, the one who had made the diagnosis. We don't want a do not resuscitate notice putting on her notes, said the son, who'd read about such things and whose wife was a nurse working in another hospital. Of course not, said the doctor. He then went away, and the husband and the son saw him talking to two nurses. By now, it was late in the evening. The doctor disappeared, but one of the nurses arrived at the bedside. She was carrying a syringe. She could be like this for months, said the nurse. She could be suffering a great deal, but she's unconscious, pointed out the son. His mother, who was breathing normally, seemed to be quite peaceful. We've decided to give her something to help her, said the nurse. What is it? Asked the husband. It's two medicines, said the nurse. It's a mixture of midazolam and morphine. It'll help her rest. We don't want her suffering. She could be like this for months. After giving the injection, the nurse suggested that the husband and the son went home. When they returned to the hospital the following morning, their wife and mother was dead. We were just about to call you, said another nurse, who seemed very sympathetic. The doctor came. He, too, was sympathetic. It was only afterwards, when they were at home, that the man and his son realized that their wife and mother had been killed. Deliberately, cold-bloodedly killed. There had been absolutely no reason to give the now infamous and widely used kill shot of midazolam and morphine. People who've had strokes can make a full recovery, said the woman's daughter-in-law as they talked when they were back home. I remember that film star Patricia Neal, said the husband. Her husband was Roald Dahl. She made films again, despite having had a stroke. The three of them were numb. It didn't occur to them that they'd just witnessed a murder. But that's what it was. It wasn't euthanasia, it wasn't mercy killing, it certainly wasn't treatment. The hospital staff killed that woman because stroke victims can take months to recover. They didn't want a woman over 70 using a bed on one of their wards. Beds have been in short supply in British hospitals for years. There are fewer beds than bureaucrats. And it wasn't manslaughter either, by any definition. It was premeditated, cold-blooded murder. Murder, remember, is the unlawful premeditated murder, the unlawful premeditated killing of one human being by another. What else would you call it when a patient in hospital is killed without their consent and without the consent of relatives and without the consent of a court of law? Nor was this incident rare. Pretty much the same thing is happening every day in hospitals all around the world. Staff put patients to sleep in the same way that a vet might put a dog or a cat to sleep. They kill patients whom they think might need a good deal of nursing or medical care. What is happening is exactly what I predicted almost 3 years ago at the beginning of 2020, when I warned that one of the reasons for the COVID fraud was to find an excuse to kill the elderly and to save billions on pension payments. The government's boasted about the money they've saved. In my book, Coming Apocalypse, which was published in April 2020, right at the start of this fraud, I said that life would never again be as good as it was in January 2020. And I stand by that, I'm afraid. Those who sneered might perhaps like to think again. I've been lied about and banned, but everything I've said, written and predicted has been accurate. I wish it hadn't been. In many hospitals all around the world, the term palliative care ward is now a synonym for death camp, as the killing of the elderly, which started in 2020, gathers pace. First, there was the Liverpool care pathway, whereby elderly patients were deliberately starved to death or deprived of fluid until they died. Then the United Nations effectively allowed doctors around the world to kill people over the age of 70 without anyone caring. And care home staff were allowed to dose the elderly with tranquilizers and sleeping tablets without telling the patients or their relatives what was happening. It was and is all perfectly legal. Now, of course, there aren't as many care home staff as there were. Thousands of them left their jobs when they were told they had to have a dangerous, ineffective COVID jab, a so-called vaccine which they knew from observation was a killer. And there's the kill shot, the mixture of midazolam and morphine which takes medical care one step further than the do not resuscitate notice casually scrawled on the medical notes of anyone who looks too sick to bother with. I described it as murder in the early summer of 2020, and that's what it still is. At the moment, of course, it's usually anyone over 70 or anyone disabled or chronically sick, whether physically or mentally ill, who gets murdered. Though in some hospitals, anyone over 65 is vulnerable, and soon it'll be anyone over 60, and then it'll be anyone over 50, and then the slippery slope gets ever steeper. Doctors and nurses who have the power of death over life are murdering people every day in our hospitals, and no one gives a damn. I suspect that the doctors and nurses don't even realise that what they're doing isn't just ethically wrong, it's also legally wrong. It's the reason anyone over 60 or anyone ill should do everything they can to keep out of hospitals.
Well, that's Vernon Coleman there with quite a pretty horrific story. It's difficult to know. He's not really naming anybody involved in that story. Could be making it up, Martin.
Well, that's the first thing I thought. If you're going to make that kind of allegation in a specific case where he knew what the mother said to the father about things, then you've got to give the names.
Well, although not necessarily. The family might not want that.
Okay, well, let's just presume for the sake of argument that that's an accurate account of something that happened. It could easily be. Yeah? That's certainly...
This midazolam morphine thing is quite well known about, isn't it?
That's a good point, yeah. And he's making a good point there. And I thought, well, you know, the pressure on beds in this country is all to do with austerity. You know, it's the decisions, economic and political decisions have been made, which have led to the deaths of millions of people.
It's the kickback from 2008, isn't it?
That's right.
You know, it's
all
basically
the money that might have gone to
Osborne and Cameron.
Yeah, well, and also that's what went on in this country. In other countries, the names were different, but the policies were the same. Because, you know, we don't really control any of this. I think when he's talking about the world at large, large numbers of people in the world have no access to hospitals or healthcare at all, and they are allowed to die. That's what happens. They get ill and they die. And there's nothing, you know, it's only in relatively developed countries where there's some aspiration to keeping the general population healthy.
I don't think anyone's saying that the lady in question would definitely have recovered, but and the point is, they're not really giving her a chance. I remember 1996, this is the publication date for Vernon Carmel's book, How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. Yeah. He was already aware that at the time that there were protocols coming in, which actually where you went to your doctor and they might actually give you something which the drug companies have induced them to give you rather than something that's going to help you get better.
Well, I was just going to make the point about Big Pharma. The general allegation against Big Pharma is that what they're doing is developing drugs for which are not designed to cure illness, but are designed to ameliorate whatever the symptoms are so that they can carry on selling you more drugs. And I'll tell an anecdote. A friend of mine spoke to somebody who was a researcher for a pharmaceutical company. And she said to her, well, that must be quite a noble profession. She said, no, not really. What our business model is exactly what I've just said. And in fact, you know, that's, if you go.
What, you mean keeping people ill?
Keeping people ill.
Dependent.
It's an illness industry. But don't forget that runs counter to the idea of killing people off. Yeah? So there's a tension there.
I think he's talking about beds, isn't he? Freeing up beds.
I think for the government, killing people off is more straightforward because, as he says, pension payments and so on.
Saving on pension payments, fantastic amount of money.
Yeah, and we could come back to the plandemic and all the rest of it. That's all part of the plan. But, of course, I don't agree with Vernon Coleman that there was no COVID. I think it was a biological warfare attack.
I'm not sure he says that, actually. But anyway, the reason I'm talking about these subjects, 5G and the jabs particularly, that one is the midazolam morphine jab, is because these are protocols. Basically, the nurses, the hospitals are told to follow them. It's all part of the way that they're regulated, and they're not necessarily any good for the patients. But is because of the disappearance this week of a chap called Mark Stein from GB News. Now, any of our regular listeners will probably have heard me say, you know, for the last year or so, on and off, that you know, oh well, I can, you know, Mark Stein takes off on GB News. How wonderful, maybe I can just retire, because he was doing such a brilliant job there, bringing together many of the genuine worries about the pandemic particularly, but also about many other issues. And he disappeared. I think the last programme of his on GB News was around about a month ago, courtesy of, apparently, Ofcom. And it was announced officially this week, GB News presenter Mark Stein has quit after Ofcom row over breach of standards. GB News presenter Mark Stein, this is in The Express, resigned from his presenting role after he claimed the broadcaster said he would be financially responsible for any potential Ofcom crimes. Well, this is no good at all, is it? Fines. It's not a crime. you can get fined by Ofcom. A spokesperson from GB News confirmed to The Express the broadcaster has received no fines from Ofcom. They would never make their presenters pay Ofcom fines. However, they went on to point out there are two Ofcom investigations ongoing regarding the Mark Stein show for breach of standards and for misinformation over the COVID vaccine. Complaints regarding the vaccine were sparked when Mark spoke with author and journalist Dr. Naomi Wolf, somebody we may even have carried that clip on here, tail end of last year. Mark has been off air since suffering two heart attacks, and in a new clip shared on his website, the 63-year-old made some claims about his departure from the show. As he held up his contract from GB News, Mark begins, "The state of play between me and GB News is they've sent me a contract." After skimming a couple of clauses, the presenter explained, "The broadcaster decided we need a defibrillator in the studio for me to be able to go back." He's claimed the GB News chief executive chose to change the terms by which we do the show. So I think really Mark needs to properly publish that information. If that's the contract they asked him to sign, that he would have to pay for Ofcom fines. This means really that his broadcaster's not backing him. And so, of course, he's going to have to leave at that point. And, well, mind you, if I'd have been told at BCFM that Pat Hart wasn't backing me, who was the manager there, I would have just carried on anyway, because I'm quite confident that we could fight any kind of Ofcom thing, which we very successfully did. But anyway, let Martin comment on this. Let's have a listen from Mark Stein himself, who, as the Express says, published an update this week.
Hey, remember me? Mark Stein. I'm not dead. Well, okay, I could be dead, and the nurses just haven't told me yet. But until they do, I'm working on the assumption that my corporeal existence remains ongoing. I've had two heart attacks, which isn't fun, although it's more fun than the average BAFTA award ceremony, but I'm headed back. I just need to mitigate my post-cardiac haggardness with a couple of Botox injections and a new hairpiece, because my old hairpiece turned white, hence the bad dye job on it. And after all that, we're going to be raring to go. I thank you for all your cards. This one is from Vaccine Injured and Bereaved UK, Vibuck. You can see Hibsy and Charlotte and Joe and others who've appeared on this show with me, vaccine victims, and I thank them for this card. It's totally irresponsible sending a card this heavy to a heart attack victim, because there's no surer way to bring on your third heart attack than trying to lift a card this size. So don't do that again next time, guys, because otherwise I'll think it's deliberate. I know what you're saying. How do we know this hasn't been stitched together from pre-taped video filmed back in the Liz Truss era when we knew Stein was alive? So I'm going to do what the hostages do in the hostage videos and hold up a copy of today's newspaper to prove that I'm alive. Here you go. Hot off the presses. Mrs. Thatcher forced out of office by duplicitous backstabbers among her own supposed that. Wait a minute. 23rd November 1990, is this the most recent one they had? The Mark Stein Show, all your favourite guests, all the stuff that matters, and no tedious political gossip whatsoever about which of the indistinguishable transient losers is going to be next week's Lord Privy Seal. We don't go there. But we're coming back with all your favourite guests, all the stuff that matters, coming soon. Stay safe, stay free.
Yeah, but where? No one's really quite sure whether. Mark, by the way, does his own jazz program on one of the internet radio outlets. He says, and in the final bit of this Express article, he says, GB News, the contract that is, says that GB News will ensure that the presenter and the US producers attend regular Ofcom training provided by the company's compliance officer. He said, this is the final point I'll make on this, to the extent that the presenter and the US producers do not incorporate Ofcom regulatory input into an edition of the programme. This should be considered a material breach of the agreement. I think he's just basically fallen out with people at GB News, Martin. He possibly could have just carried on, but he just thought, well, if they're not really going to back me, I'm going to have to go elsewhere, which is a pity.
Well, I mean, obviously it's the first I've heard about this, because I'll be honest with you, Tony, I don't follow GB News apart from reading about it and hearing about it on the show.
But I mean, we're talking about censorship, and we're talking a little bit more about that. The Mark Stein Company shall indemnify GB News for any and all direct loss and liability costs, it says. Ah, this is part of the contract, actually, including reasonable legal costs, damages or expenses that it suffers as a result of any regulatory breach. So, yeah, he's quite right. They're saying if you say anything that causes a fine, that you have to pay it, effectively. That's what they're saying to a presenter.
Well, I mean, GB News is in a media environment where they work under Ofcom rules, because it's a broadcast thing. We were talking about the government having rules about stuff about 5G masks. They if you're going to broadcast a TV station, you've got to fulfil Ofcom rules. We know that because we used to be under Ofcom rules.
Oh, yeah, but
there's
a big difference. In fact, we successfully fought. In fact, I successfully fought. I had to be a barrister for a day and write a defence. But what he's saying, this is what Mark Stein's saying particularly, he's saying this is the important point. I don't have any say in our defence against an Ofcom complaint. That's all done by GB News. So what they're saying to him is, we will do the response if there is a complaint against you, but if there's a fine, you have to pay it.
Yeah, well, I mean, in other words, they're basically giving him a contract he can refuse, and he's refused it. Because presumably the producers at GB News, he may be an interesting person to have on, and he's got
an audience. Well, he certainly is.
Yes, I know, but at the same time, they want to keep their Ofcom licence. You know, and the same was true of Pat Hart. Did in fact support you over the Ofcom thing about the Israel, you know, is what's it, UK Lawyers for Israel?
No, there was no support from him. All he said is, you have to respond to me.
Yes, but he also has the power, as you well know. He can shut down any show at any time because those are the rules inside.
Well, he did. Yeah.
PCFM.
He did.
And yes, so in other words, it's not.
He couldn't get Ofcom to shut us down, himself.
Yes, but he can do that because that's the rules. That's what the rules of BCFM say. So anyway, the question is, it's all about power at the end of the day, isn't it? Censorship.
Yeah.
You're allowed to say it if it's in line with what somebody higher up agrees with, and if you say things they don't agree with, then they try and shut you down.
They certainly do. Well, I mean, I think Mark's probably one of the best things he's been doing on there is getting together whole studios full of people who have been vaccine injured, plus experts to talk about what's actually going on. Because there are a lot of people out there who believe that much of the increase in excess deaths at the moment is due to the COVID jabs. And here's one of them who I pick up a lot on Telegram and places like that, but this one really stood out to me this week. It was basically a guy with a megaphone, and there was some kind of media event going on, but there was a bit of a protest, and he just picked up his megaphone and started going at all the press that were over the other side of the road.
You make me sick, you're all vaccine traitors, media whores, joke journalists, vaccine traitors. Shame on you, media whores, you vaccine traitors, not telling us the truth, allowing our children to be masked up, allowing our children to be vaccinated for what is essentially the flu. And you knew all along, you knew the average age of death from COVID was 82. 82 is the average age of death from COVID. And you said nothing about it. You got us all in a fear frenzy. And made our children take vaccines, socially distance, and wear masks. Shame on you! Shame on you, you media whores!
Yes,
you
brother!
Vaccine traitors! Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you! Remember this! When you're there with your vaccine-damaged child or your vaccine-damaged grandchildren or your children that have trouble dealing with cleanliness, normal things, dealing with social issues, and you allowed them to socially distance, probably the biggest crime against children ever. You didn't let them play. You didn't let them see their grandma. You let them be masked up. Shame on you, you media whores. Shame on you. You're disgusting. You're absolutely disgusting. Picking up the devil's lucre for what you do. You should rot in hell. You will rot in hell. And it's a hell of your own making. Because you know your guilt. You know your complicity in all this. You know you have said nothing. You know that you have been pushing this fake agenda. Fake agenda that is against any sort of normal human behaviour. Who have been pushing these vaccines when people did not need to take these vaccines? And now we have nearly 2 million excess deaths since the COVID vaccine rollout worldwide. Look into it. Nearly 2 million excess deaths since the COVID vaccine rollout worldwide. Get that Check it out on the VAERS website in America, on the Utrecht Incident website in Europe, and in the Office of National Statistics. Check it out. It's all there. MHRA as well. It is all there. The facts are plain to see. And these media traitors can't find a link, can't find the facts in what is probably the biggest genocide since the Holocaust. The biggest genocide. And these traitors all around can't find a story in it. Shame on you, you vaccine traitors, media whores, betrayers of our children. Shame on you, shame on you, shame on you.
Well, there you go. That's what you get. I think when you find censorship going on in the mass media, is you'll get people having a rant at the journalists. And in fact, you know, I'm part of a group called Holding the Line, which is HTL, which is holding-the-line.com. And we have all sort of got together basically saying, look, there's been a tremendous amount of disinformation. And we are at least trying to make a line in the sand saying, well, look, you know, we need to have balance. In fact, that was why we were booted off of the FM airwaves here in Bristol, was simply because I was trying to put both sides and warn about the dangers of vaccines from the past. But, I mean, I think, you know, we can say that that ranter, whoever he was, Martin, is almost, you know, I think almost of the English Civil War and the ranters back then. Some people just saw massive injustices going on. They decided that in those days they didn't have megaphones. They'd stand on the street corner and just go for it.
Well, if you say he's a ranter, he was. And of course the ranters were very, very marginal in what went on during the English Civil War. But of course they were made somewhat famous by Christopher Hill's books about the radical end of the English Civil War.
Well, there's some songs as well. Chumbawamba and
sorts,
people like that.
There's all sorts of things, but that's modern, you know. At the time they were regarded as that chap probably would be regarded as somebody not in the mainstream in the ways...
Most definitely not, no.
Well, then there you are.
But he's right about the fear frenzy. I think
No, he's not, Tony.
Yes, he was.
No, he's mixed... No, the fear frenzy... I've been reading Ron Onze's stuff about excess deaths from vaccines. He's gone through all the stats. I have sent you some of it, and you said you were going to use it, but you've obviously not looked at it.
I used it that week.
No, there
yes,
are some,
I did. I put it down
there
that
quite,
week.
Quite
Martin,
a lot.
Just a minute. Come on. You know, you've got to get your facts straight. When you said you talked about that Rollins article, I put it out with that week's show.
Okay.
When so, I emailed it out to
okay,
people.
Okay. So the point about he is making, he's entered into a dialogue with people who are, I've got his concerns about vaccines. He's worried about Big Pharma. He's mRNA vaccines clearly are something different from previous vaccines and all the rest of it. But don't mix that up with social distancing, masks, because that is to do with biological warfare. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard spelled it out within weeks of the beginning of the crisis. We think this is a biological warfare attack.
Surely,
and they went to the United Nations. It was ignored in our media.
Okay.
And, of course, the whole thing about
COVID itself being
a biological warfare agent has been completely ignored, both in the mainstream media and also in the alternative media. Because they're too busy talking about the genocide and Holocaust of vaccines.
It wasn't ignored on Fox News or on Steve Hilton's show whatsoever,
indeed,
was it?
Indeed, I think.
And, in fact, even the Mail covered it, I think, a little bit.
But I think we're getting there on that.
Yeah, we are. And, you know, slowly but surely
people
are making
it. Don't forget, Jeffrey Sachs has put his hand up and said, look, you know, this is a biological agent.
You don't think there was any overuse of fear in the media during the COVID 2 years of COVID?
I think different countries had different strategies, Tony, because they all perceived it differently.
Isn't this what the Nudge Unit does?
Yeah,
psychological insights team.
The whole purpose of the plandemic, and it was a plandemic, is to create fear in society so you can then organise them in the way you want to organise them. That's exactly what it was about. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a danger. I mean, the Chinese have decided to end all of their zero COVID, but they're having a massive wave of people dying of COVID as a result, which is always going to be the way of it. Because it's a war, and lots of people are already dead. Some are dead from vaccines, possibly.
I mean,
but loads of people have died from COVID. All those people who died from COVID, Tony, are war victims. Because it was deliberate.
Today's iteration of COVID is no worse than the common cold.
Well, that's why Xi Jinping and the Chinese have decided we might as well take it on the chin now.
And that's why Rob Hanson might be going back to Hong Kong. Anyway, so I just thought that was a good introduction to our next item, which is Tony Benn, actually. And here he is in a lecture. This is one of the things that, and I'm doing these from time to time. It was a lecture that I produced, actually, back in 2006 at the Arts Centre, the Arnold Feeney here in Bristol, with Tony Benn, and it was called The Media and the Political Process. So I've re-uploaded that to YouTube now. YouTube took that down, along with my public inquiry channel, which had got 25 million views. It's a little bit irritating, but to be expected from the US deep state. This little sort of front door window for the National Security Agency obviously doesn't like people like me, and if it can just press a button and get rid of all my videos, it will do so, and it did. But you know, it's a pity that these things were no longer available, so I've just made sure it's re-uploaded. And so here is a little clip from the beginning of Tony Benn's lecture. It was lovely to work with him over a few weeks. Just got had a discussion with him about what to talk about. He was a National Union of Journalists member, and I was the secretary of the branch here in Bristol, the union, and he was very happy to come back to Bristol, where he'd been an MP, to give this talk. So here's a little excerpt from the start of it, which is now up on YouTube again. It's called The Media and the Political Process, after YouTube took him down, the swines.
Information is the most powerful weapon in the world, and always has been. Of course, if you have a gun and can control everybody else, the information they get is that if you disobey the leader, you'll be shot. That's information. And fear is information, and is used crudely now to control people. The church was a media. There was a time when you had to go to church, and then the control of what came out of religion. You see, in 1401, just before I was elected to the House of Commons, they passed the Heresy Act, under which it was a criminal offence for any person who wasn't a priest to read the Bible, because they didn't want the news of the Bible to get into the wrong hands. And you were burned at the stake as a heretic if you read the Bible. The Church of England was nationalised. It's our oldest nationalised industry, because it was so powerful. Then you had Caxton, you had Milton, his campaign for press freedom. The Royal Mail, I was Postmaster General once, and I wondered why Charles II had nationalised the post office. I thought, was he an early unrecognised socialist? The reason he did it was he wanted to open everybody's letters. And the only way he could do it was having the Royal Mail. So the Royal Mail was the birth of MI5. Then, of course, we had Rowland Hill, who was a 19th century precursor of the Internet. People could get information for the first time. Then you had the BBC. Now, that was nationalised, too, because it was too powerful to leave in private hands. And now, of course, with Murdoch and the tabloids, you have it concentrated in many other ways. But influence is power, and we saw in the American elections one example of that. Now, having talked about the information we need, they don't want us to know anything, but they want to know all about us. They bug our phones, ID card, database, so that everything about us is known to them and can be used for what purposes they like. So that is the background, and the power of the media is great and growing. It has a very close relationship with politicians, I think a slightly incestuous one, each trying to influence the other, and it is a struggle for power. And you see, wealth and power are indivisible. In the old days it was land and factories, but now it is really the control of information that is the greatest power that the wealthy have. And the use of religion. Now, this appalling idea, Bush said that God wanted him to go into Iraq. I didn't know God had such a hands-on view of current affairs. Then Osama bin Laden says, if you don't believe in the Quran, be executed. Then the Jews come up with a wonderful idea that when Moses went up Mount Sinai, he allocated Palestine to the Jews. I didn't know God was an estate agent, but apparently that was his function. And at every period in history, there's been a conventional wisdom you have to accept, whether it was the empire, a foreign enemy, the Cold War, everyone was a communist. Remember, we were told that if we didn't have NATO, the Red Army would arrive in Bristol and we'd all have to read Stalin. And the demonizing of people they don't like and the praising of people they do. And that is the basis of a great deal of power.
So that's a sort of opening gambit, really, of Tony Benn's lecture, The Media and the Political Process. Of course, the it's the fourth estate, isn't it? We've got the executive, we've got the legislature, the lawmakers, we've got the judiciary. Well, without the press, those other three are not held to account.
Well, in theory, that's why in the American Revolution, pamphleteering was an extremely important part of it, as it was in England in the 1640s and 1680s. I mean, once you've got the printing press and you can make little pamphlets, that was the internet of its day. Yeah, people, but we've now got a much, much expanded media world. I mean, people live literally all their waking time in the media world with their phones, looking at their phones and so on.
And our legislature seemed to be going down in quality the whole time. I mean, this is surely due to the selection process in the main political parties of who becomes and who doesn't become an MP. We know that the Labour Party, particularly here in Bristol, has seized control of this whole process with one of our guests, who was on here, gosh, must be about a year ago or so, being told that she just wasn't suitable to become a candidate. Now, ex-MP Jared O'Mara has this week been jailed for 4 years over fraud to feed his cocaine habit. O'Mara, 41, was convicted yesterday of 6 counts of fraud after he and members of his staff attempted to submit fake expense claims worth £24,000 in the name of a fictitious disability support charity. So he's done 4 years in jail for expenses fraud, this ex-MP, Labour MP, and... Yeah, so this is, yeah, jurors at Leeds Crown Court were told he was branded dishonest and rotten by the prosecution. He used the cash to fund his extravagant lifestyle and a galloping cocaine habit. I mean, that's not what MPs should be doing, is it?
No, and he's paid the price, as he should. I mean, that's not really on at all, is it? Let's face it.
The ex-Labour MP made headlines after ousting Lib Dem Nick Clegg, the former Deputy Prime Minister, from his seat in Sheffield. So he took over from Nick Clegg, but then he was no better himself.
Well, I mean, Nick Clegg hasn't been sent down for 4 years for COVID.
What I'm saying is the poor people of Sheffield, they got a hell of a raw deal there,
well,
didn't they?
Well, yeah, but what's happened is that politics has become, in the US, for example, each election cycle is more expensive than the previous election cycle. So you have to spend a huge amount of money on social media as well as mainstream media, telephone banking, all the rest of it. It's a huge expense. And of course, ultimately, making it a huge expense means that the wealthy control the process. Mm. The Supreme Court years ago just passed this bill that allowed any amount of money to be thrown at any election by anybody. And that's supposedly freedom. But what it means is that the wealthy control every stage of the process, including the people that supposedly oppose them, who are on the payroll as well.
This is Labour, who are supposed to present some sort of alternative to that world. He was almost immediately, apparently, after he became an MP, rocked by scandal after a string of misogynistic and homophobic message board posts, alongside allegations about his behaviour whilst working as a bar manager and DJ at the city's West Street Live venue. After being suspended, he was then reinstated by Labour, but then he decided almost immediately in 2018 to just leave, claiming he wasn't made to feel welcome in the party. So this is amazing, isn't it? The Labour Party reinstate this cocaine fanatic, and yet they've expelled Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, it says a lot. What's probably happened is that he made the right noises about which direction the party was going in. Incidentally, I just heard earlier that Starmer came to Bristol this week, and Marvin was on one of the picket lines, and Starmer was asked what he thought of Marvin being on one of the picket lines, and he said he was absolutely outraged and Marvin was doing the wrong thing, etc. So these are the kind of fight. The Labour Party is a broad church. It's got Marvin and Starmer in and me in. So there you go. And it's always been a huge battle to get getting the right people is going to be very difficult under any circumstances. Ask Jurgen Klopp, who tries to manage the Liverpool football team. It's always going to be hard. because the wrong people push themselves forward. The right people don't want to do it because they've got other things they think that, you know, a lot of the people that ought to be put forward for politics don't want to do it because of the, all the nonsense that goes with it. And therefore, the people that do put themselves forward, Liz Truss is back in the Telegraph justifying everything and bidding for another go. I mean, you've got to have a certain kind of ego to want to do that sort of thing, haven't you?
Well, it's interesting. I thought her intervention this week was hilarious, really, because she has no real credibility. She completely bombed from day one, and yet she seems to think that the world wants to listen to what she's got to say about it all.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? But, I mean, you've got to have an absolute... I mean, you know, the ego involved to be in politics at that level is ridiculous. Yet for every... Nelson Mandela, who does 22 years in prison as his apprenticeship, you've got nitwits like Liz Truss who think they could do the job, you know, and it's Dunning-Kruger syndrome. Have you ever come across that, Tony? Dunning-Kruger syndrome is a recognised thing. It's where people who are not really competent have an overestimation of their own competence. And you see it a lot in middle management and in senior management. In, you know, everybody, you know, going back to this whole thing about being promoted one level above your level of competence.
Isn't that also called imposter syndrome?
Yes, well, that's it. But Dunning-Kruger syndrome...
We've got plenty of that around.
What you tend to find is that people who are not actually that good at whatever it is think that they are. And what tends to happen is people who are good at something tend to underestimate. They can see the problems. They think, ooh, that might be a problem. Whereas people who overestimate their own abilities are often, you know, they're the ones who make the messes because they just think that they don't, you know, they can just bluff it. Look at Boris Johnson, the classic bluffer of the old school. Just make it up as you go along. Peppa Pig, anybody?
So anyway, I will endeavour to find out what... I mean, it's interesting you say Starmer was in Bristol this week. He's the only headline I can see about that is NHS nurses strike is a badge of shame for the government. So he sounds to me as if he's backing the strike, but he's saying that it's a very bad thing for Marvin to go on to a picket line.
This is the ridiculous nature. I mean, you can see there's a tension in the shadow cabinet about this. Because a lot of shadow cabinet members feel that, you know, going down to the picket line won't do them any harm at all. But Starmer is pitching his pitch to the scared middle class in the middle.
He was here at Airbus. That's what he was doing.
Yeah, but he was asked about what he thought about Marvin being on a picket line. And of course, from Marvin's point of view, him going down to that picket line means that he's decided that he's going to defy Starmer. Yeah. So that's what he's manoeuvring at, yeah? Because everybody's playing games. This politics is all about presentation, isn't it?
Yeah, well, if Marvin Rees is going to actually stand as a Labour MP, he does need to sort of up his game a little bit.
Well, I mean, presumably, don't forget Starmer's in Filton. That's probably where Marvin's going to stand. And he's trying, you know, he's carving out. Don't forget, Marvin, when the Corbyn first became the leader, he was under pressure from the Labour MPs in Bristol to denounce Corbyn, and he refused to do it. So you've got to, you know, Marvin's politics are quite specific, really. I mean, whatever criticisms one may make of what he's been doing as mayor, he's not necessarily a natural Starmerite.
Well, he's going to be running to become MP for Bristol North East. He's going to have to make sure he doesn't annoy... I suppose he's thinking, well, if I
go on the picket line in Bristol North East, and I look as if I'm a bit of a... You know, he's not looking to be in a Starmer cabinet. He's looking to be an MP with an independent voice for Bristol. I'm sure that's the way he's thinking. Because he doesn't really want to go anywhere else, because he sees himself as a local boy and all the rest of it.
Well, meanwhile, the RMT, the train drivers, or sorry, train workers union, has rejected another offer today from the government, really. I mean, we have to say the government, because we know that it's not the train companies, the train operating companies, that are really behind this. It is the government that are telling them what to do. End of last week, we had, I thought was an interesting speech by Mick Lynch. I'm not sure he's made any big speeches today, but these are at the rallies that were around on last week's strikes.
Hello! What a beautiful sight! Welcome to Westminster, the House of Fools and the House of the Corrupt. Last year, Grant Shapps, remember him? He's still around, lurking around all these buildings around here, running the government, telling Rishi Sunak what to do, trying to ban the working class. He was telling the media that the railway workers have got no friends, that we'd be back at work. And how dare we ask for a pay rise when teachers can't afford to live, when nurses are a more deserving case, when public sector workers can't get a pay deal. And our message then, as it is today, every worker needs a pay rise. Every worker needs a square deal. And our message is both this. We demand and we are united. We will not be divided on the basis of who we work for. We will not be divided on the basis of our belief or the colour of our skin or the part of the country we're from. We are the working class. We are back. We are here. We are demanding change. We refuse to be poor. And we are going to win for our people on our terms. So let the message go out. This is a London-only demonstration. There are marches and demonstrations throughout the country. More workers will join us. More ballots will come forward. More demands will be made. And in all that time, this government of the corrupt and the incompetent will seek to obscure the issues. The issue is they are responsible for your poverty and they have got to solve it. And if they're not able to, they need to get out of the way now. Let's get a general election on and let's get a new government that acts on behalf of our people. So I hope you enjoyed your day out today. It's been great to see so many new people coming into our movement, coming into our campaigns, on strike for the first time ever. We're not going to win it in one day. We're going to win it by staying the course. We're going to have to dig in. We're going to have to fight for our future. This is the fight of our generation, and it's a fight for our whole people. So let's pledge ourselves. Stick together. Solidarity to the workers. Victory to the working people. Up the unions. Victory for us. Victory for our people. Forward together. Thank you very much.
Yes, so that's the railway workers. They sort of almost like the leaders of the strike. I think, in a way, if they were to settle, the whole thing might slowly peter out, Martin.
Well, the railway workers, steel workers and miners were called the Triple Alliance back in the 1920s and the 1900s.
But it's a different landscape completely.
It is
now.
But the railway workers are still there. Steel workers have all gone and the miners have all gone. So the railway workers are the last of that tradition because they couldn't be removed. I mean, they were more skilled, basically. Yes, of course, and Mick Lynch is actually, you know, that was a much better rant than the chap earlier, and that was much more enjoyable to listen to. But of course...
He's representing a whole lot more people. Representing himself.
Well, indeed, yes.
In fact, it's worth saying that the unions actually do represent far more than many of these main political parties,
don't they? Yes. I mean, a lot of it is quite passive. So
and they're more democratic.
Well, they are in principle, yes.
Well, they are. I think that, you know, certainly our union, which is having a delegate meeting, I think it's in April coming up, the main policies of the union are decided by the membership at a vote. As the delegates get together, they decide what the policy of the union is going to be.
All right, but I'm just saying that there is a lot of people who are in unions who take no part other than just being members. So there is a lot, you know, and there's a net tendency for the activists to think that everybody is as you know, switched on to this stuff as they are. Look, can I just make one point quickly? The FBU balletted for strike action.
The Fire Brigade Union.
And the local authority employers, who are their employers, gave them a better offer. And they're now going to ballot their members about not going on strike. And it looks like they're not going to go on strike.
Yeah.
And what the other union leaders were saying is if the government was to come up with a sensible offer, then we could talk about about calling it off.
The
Tory government don't want to come up with a reasonable offer because then it will look as if they are weak to their own supporters.
I was thinking about this.
They've got them all going that they're going to break the unions.
I was just thinking about this yesterday. Isn't it interesting that when and there's a free service put out there by the state which rescues people's property when it catches on fire, then suddenly there's a settlement. It's a little bit easier to make a settlement than, rather than someone that's going to care for your mum or dad in hospital.
Well, I think the difference is that the local authorities are not the same kind of employers as the central government. The central government, don't forget the Tories are now locked into a kind of doom loop of their own devising where they're fighting each other. Rishi Sunak and his advisers really thought that by being tough on the unions, they could win the next election in this country.
No, I don't think so. I don't think they want to win. I think they've given up, basically. They're trying to stick the knife into the unions, just as Thatcher did back in the 1980s.
Yes, but that's what they're talking amongst themselves, that this is a
all they really care about is returns on their shares.
No. The
unions threaten that.
The Tory strategists inside the Tory party, you know, we're talking about the political people, they saw this confrontation with Mick Lynch and all these unions. They see Mick Lynch as Arthur Scargill. Yeah, but of course, Mick Lynch has actually got a wider support than Arthur Scargill, because this isn't just a miners' strike. This is across the whole public sector and lots of private sector companies as well.
Lots of talk of comparing what's going on today back to the 1980s and the Thatcher era. And I just thought it would be really... I mean, we had a little bit from Tony Benn earlier, but he said all sorts of fascinating stuff. I don't know where the Tony Benns are nowadays in the Labour Party. His son, Hilary Benn, is completely the opposite. He seems to be... A Blairite, basically, which Tony would have probably upset Tony Benn if he'd known about it. But so let's have a listen now to Tony Benn's analysis of Thatcherism, because I think it's fascinating to hear what he thinks was really behind the mass sell-offs in the 1980s.
And you see, when we come to the Thatcher period, this is what's so interesting. Thatcher was a much cleverer woman than we give her credit for. She knew perfectly well the strength of the labour movement lay in three sources of power. One was the trade union movement. So she took on the miners, described these courageous and skilled people as the enemy within. For God's sake, what an insult to the people who built our economy in the sweat of their labour. And she introduced legislation that made trade unions actually illegal. You can't be a proper trade unionist now because your rights are taken away. So what she said, and this is very clever, she said, well, you can buy a council house, so you'll be a property owner. You may not be able to get a wage increase, but you can borrow. And the borrowing was deliberately encouraged because people in debt are slaves to their employers. That's how the whole thing began. And that's why borrowing was a deliberate policy to make the working class today slaves again. And that's exactly what they are. I mean, many trade unions don't go on strike because they're afraid they lose their job and lose their home. And so that's what the policy was. She also attacked local government, which was the beginning of further education and school education in schools and all that. And she destroyed local government. So local councils now are just agents of the Treasury. They can only spend money the Treasury gives them on things the Treasury tells them they can spend it on. They're sub-agents of a sort of right-wing bank. And she attacked the public sector and privatised it. And this privatisation is internationally. I met an old friend of mine called Kenneth Kaunda, who's the president of Zambia. I met him when he came out of a British prison years ago, before he was president. And he said, we had a great debt, and the IMF came along, and he said, I'll lift your debt if you'll sell off all your schools and hospitals to multinational corporations. So privatisation is a deliberate policy, along with the destruction of local democracy and the destruction of the trade union, to restore power back to where it was. And what we are now back in, that's what the whole crisis is about, the restoration of power of those who always control the world, the people who own the land and the resources and all the rest of it. And that is something we need to understand. And just getting, when I hear the government say we want to restore confidence in the banking system, well, I must say, I don't want to restore such confidence in the banking system. They do it all over again. Because this theory that wealth trickles down, actually wealth bubbles up to the people at the very top. And I mean, look at these obscene bonuses they're getting. What is it, the head of British Gas gets $4 million a year. Top income, I think, is $22 million a year for somebody in this country, and then perpetual squeezing down the line. So that's what I think we have to do, and I do think we should, and this is why I think this meeting with the direct experience of people from different sectors is so important. You mentioned the post office. When I was Postmaster General, I set up the Gyro Bank. It became the sixth biggest bank in Britain, and I tell you one thing, and that was without nationalising anybody. I tell you one thing, The Gyro Bank would have not played the game of the bankers in London. So what did Thatcher do? She sold it to Alliance and Leicester, closed it down. And that was because she was not prepared to see public enterprise survive even when it succeeded. And so what we have to do is to have a long-term plan in our mind. Mind you, the short-term battle is going to be a big one. But the longer term, all the banks should be publicly owned. And if you put money into the banks, the first thing you say to them is no more bonuses this Christmas. That would just be a start. And then see that the money is directed to help people who need to raise money for businesses or do whatever is necessary. Then all the public services, gas, electricity, water, transport should be publicly owned. Of course they should be. And actually, that's not a difficult argument to put across. We're not alone if we say that. Tory former Thatcherite minister said to me, a time ago on a television programme, it was a catastrophe to privatise the railways. Well, if they think it, Labour might have thought the same too. And I think these arguments, I say this to build confidence at the end, don't think we're an isolated little group. I go around the country doing meetings all the time. I'm engaged in a permanent by-election, and I'm not the candidate, and there's no polling there. And what really pleases me is the way the arguments you've been put tonight put into any audience, and you'd be surprised how much support there is. They don't want the war, they don't want privatisation, they don't want pensions and needs tests, they don't want students saddled with debt, they don't want civil liberties taken away, they do want Labour properly able to pay for it. So we're not alone. And it is very important to keep optimism. I think there's a characteristic of the left to be professionally pessimistic. And I don't go for that. I think progress has been made by two flames that have always been burning in the human heart. The flame of anger against injustice and the flame of hope you can build a better world. And if this meeting leads to more meetings like this where we can exchange our experience and keep those two flames burning, maybe this is a turning point, but not for quite the reason that New Labour thought it might be. Thank you for asking me anyway, and if I got to slip off.
So, former Bristol MP and statesman nearly became leader of the Labour Party and potentially Prime Minister as well, Tony Benn, didn't he, Martin?
Well, he nearly became leader of the Labour Party, but whether he'd have been Prime Minister is open to debate because of his... he was demonised completely by the Tory establishment in this country and by the Labour right wing. And, of course, his protégé, Jeremy Corbyn, gave it a good go in recent memory.
Wasn't it Neil Kinnock he was up against?
He was up against Dennis Healey to be deputy leader, yeah.
Oh, okay. But anyway, I think he does a pretty good job there. He's talking, I mean, particularly about the people that own the land and the resources are basically used privatisation in the 80s, you know, because there was a settlement after World War II that was saying, well, everyone's been through this war, let's make sure everyone's got enough to live, etc., etc., that the 1980s was basically grabbing all that stuff back, the family silver, off of the nation and off of the people of Britain.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I mentioned before, there's a Polish-British economist called Kalecki, and in the 1950s and right up into the 1970s, when I was studying economics, there was a view that, I mean, it was only people on the left who talked about capitalism. People like me in my earnest teenage years, and my economics tutors would say, well, there's no such thing as capitalism anymore. It's called the market economy. And it's not capitalism as it used to be. There's all sorts of government intervention. We manage things. We don't allow slumps and crashes. And that was true. I mean, it was actually quite well managed. And there's no reason why we couldn't have carried on doing that. This is, at 63 years old, this is what infuriates me. We could have carried on just bodging along with a mixed economy, and instead we had this radicalism of Thatcher, Reagan, and it was, you know, it's basically a counter-revolution. What Kalecki was saying is the problem is not that it doesn't work, it's that it works too well, and the ruling class are still there, and they're just not going to put up with it. They put up with it with a great deal of grumbling, but they couldn't make the kind of money they thought they deserved, and that's why they brought it back to we've now got a 19th century style setup, which we thought we'd buried forever.
Yeah, but
and
you know what?
We're right back in
all across Bristol. We've got cranes on the horizon, and apparently this is a great thing. Isn't that true? I mean, if you're seeing many buildings being built, even if it is on next to Castle Park View, the most absolutely hideous, disgusting looking, I think, isn't it, 25-story office block. It's just square. It looks hideous. It cuts the sun out from the park. This is, I mean, you know, we're being told this is a great thing, that Bristol's got loads and loads of tower blocks being built everywhere. But is it really?
Well, I mean, that's just a more specific point, but I would say this: we spend our money on building tower blocks, which possibly will never even
become. But it's not our money, is it? It's a private money.
When I say our money,
they're
I mean the nation's money.
They're making plenty of money out of that over the next 50, 100 years
or
so.
And what we're not doing is developing small and medium enterprises like they do in Germany and Scandinavia. And that's the difference between the way Britain is run and some other Northern European countries are run. And that's why our productivity per hour is so rubbish. The whole thing about Thatcherism being at least successful economically is drivel. It was actually the performance of the British economy has been consistently below the levels that it was during the Keynesian era.
Yeah,
when
that's
the,
right.
It was managed
Absolutely
capitalism.
Absolutely right.
The idea of free market capitalism, I mean, and the apotheosis of that is Liz Truss believing that just by cutting taxes on the wealthy, the fairy dust would automatically make the economy grow. I mean, it's just absolutely
incredible. The
incredible
thing about the Kwarteng budget was the only tax there is on the super rich, which is on their income. They were going to drop that. So, I mean, there's no tax on the wealth that they've managed to accumulate over the years, very little anyway. But just thinking about this whole idea of Bristol's just becoming a property developer's paradise under our Blairite mayor, Marvin Rees, who's going to be out in around about a year's time. He's said he's resigning, and there'll probably be a green mayor takes over. Actually, there's going to be
there won't
mayor.
Be a green mayor, because there won't be any mayor.
There'll just be councillors, mayor. And we're going back to the old, more democratic councillor system with our 70 councillors. Was that a flagship project for the mayor was this place called the Boatyard on Bath Road. So if you're heading out of Bristol towards Bath on the A4 from Temple Meads, on the left hand side you'll find a massive block of flats, a 17 story apartment block. Now there were a few eyebrows raised amongst some squatter friends of mine who squatted nearby, saying, well, what they've done is they've sort of built this thing right out over the river, and it looks a bit dangerous, you know. So but it's been in the national press, in the Metro, the Mail and various other outlets. Would you live in these flats? A riverbank collapses underneath the foundations of a new 17 story apartment block. So not only did this flagship affordable housing project, which of course is not affordable, but anyway, it's now going to be luxury flats, not affordable flats, completely founder, which mayor was thinking was going to be a great project. It's now also, there's been a massive landslip underneath it, and it looks as if it's, you know, the question is, would you live in these flats? No. The answer is no, of course I wouldn't. And you certainly wouldn't have any kids near them, because it looks as if the whole thing is tipping into the river. So this is the sort of greed that you get. It's a perfect example, I think, of the greed that you get with this these speculative developments going on. They're saying, oh, we want to grab a little bit of land, we can put a few struts up there, it won't fall in the river. But it seems it is falling into the river. A 17-story apartment block.
Well, in a way, that's a metaphor for what's going to happen to the property market in general. All of this, money, bricks and mortar, you can't go wrong. We're going to find out that that's just not the case. And a lot of it is what the right-wing economists call malinvestment.
So it
should never have been made. It's got no productive function.
I'll put a picture up of this on our show page. It's unbelievable. You've got all the power lines and the drainage things kind of sticking out of the bank because all the side of the river has slipped into the Avon.
Well,
underneath the block. And you look at it, you think, how long is that going to stand there?
Well, I mean, the people who put it up will lose money, which means the insurance companies will lose money because they'll have to pay out on it, all of which adds to the debts of the private sector. And, of course, the world is awash in unpayable debt. I mean, we're reaching close to the tipping point where there could be a complete unravel.
Anyway, the housing market is starting to go down, isn't it?
That's right.
Oh dear, whoopsie daisy. What's the implications of that? Well, because it doesn't look as if it's going up, does it? It's gone over the top of the
tends to happen is that once it starts to go down, it doesn't stop. Yeah, it goes in one direction, then it goes in another direction. It's on quite big cycles. But once it starts to go in the other direction, it drags. I mean, Britain's
negative equity, under Thatcher.
Yes, that's right.
Which is what Tony Benn was talking about there.
That's what's going to happen. It's going to be Thatcherism on steroids. Even if, a Labour government will probably not do stupid things like Kwasi Kwarteng, but they won't do much to, you know, the Corbynite plan to renationalise the economy and rebalance it has been jettisoned. That's quite clear. And therefore, the Labour Party are basically pitching to the electorate, or the leadership are pitching to the electorate, is we're not as bad as the other lot. We will try and help you out where we can, but you've got to accept that we can't change X, Y, Z, whatever it is. Now, of course, in the run-up to the 2008 crash, there was lots of pressure inside the Labour Party from the rail unions, for example, saying, why don't we renationalise the railways? Because it's massively popular, seems an obvious thing to do, quite easy, because you just take the franchises back in. And the Labour government said, no, 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 we don't want to waste time and money on that. It's not a priority. But when the banks go down, then the checkbooks come out straight away, because you can't let the banks go down. This is the great elephant in the room of all these debates. The Tory party seems to think the 2008 crash never happened. So they're pushing now that one of the only things that we can get out of Brexit is we're going to deregulate the city back. You know, we're going to make it more deregulated than it was, in hopes of bringing hot money into the City of London. That is their big idea, such as it is, which is, of course, defying everything that we've learned about what you don't do with banks. And, of course, nothing has happened to the banksters. They are wealthier now than ever. Both the 2008 crash, the pandemic, and the war in Ukraine is putting money in the pockets of these people.
Well, the big developers seem to have got their talons into City Hall, particularly with this Western Harbour project, which we had a by-election last week, which Labour lost spectacularly.
Well, Labour didn't win. Labour wasn't holding the seat. It was a Lib Dem seat.
No, but Labour did lose it as well. I mean, they didn't win. And also, their vote went right down as well. I mean, this is right. These are the people that live in this area where Bristol Council wants to have this Western Harbour project, which is largely led by Business West, people like John Savage and the rest of them. It's not really led by the people or the council. They're just kind of tagging along on their coattails of these massive property speculators. But anyway, Bristol Council is now saying it wants £5.6 million to take this whole project forward from central government.
Well, I mean, we will see. What may happen? I mean, Marvin and he's been behind this project, as you know. It's quite likely. I don't know what central government's view on this will be, but you have to ask yourself the question: why, if this is a private development, do they need any extra money? And if it's not a private development, then it's a public development, so why are we allowing the private sector to run it?
Exactly, yeah, precisely. Totally agree with you there on that one. So, do you know what part of town the tower block that's falling into the River Avon is?
I'm not as au fait with these things as you are.
Totterdown.
Well, there you
perfect are. Name, isn't it? Yes. You would have thought the developers would have realised it. But anyway, look, on this issue of land, which, of course, so much of our lives are all about, and they have been since the feudal era, really. Now, of course, the idea is you're completely landless. All you can do is just pay a bribe every week or every month to someone to let you sleep somewhere, and you're constantly under threat of eviction, which is the way they seem to want people in this part of the world. And incidentally, the Russian constitution guarantees people a home. Did you know that? Scott Ritter pointed that out a few weeks ago. A chap called Jonathan Moses, who I bumped into this week, a terrific Skillshare here in Bristol about the right to roam, which I think, Martin, maybe you can say something before we hear from him about this. This may well be quite an important plank of Labour's election victory next year, mightn't it? The whole idea of land rights and the right to roam.
Well, I mean, it's good that they've picked up on it. I mean, they could have just ignored it, but they've decided not to. And I think partly it's to do with, in Scotland, the Scottish Parliament passed a right to roam in Scotland bill in memory of John Smith. Because, I mean, like a lot of Scottish MPs, he liked to bashing around the Munros. I think that it's going to come up. It's also quite useful because people who live in major urban areas are all in favour of it. And the opposition is best very much from the country landowners and people of that sort. And the Labour Party knows they're not going to get votes from the country landowners anyway. So they might as well, go for it.
They're a terrific little group, the Right to Roamers. It was interesting. They were saying that they went over to the badminton estate and did one of their trespasses over there. But I'm just saying, well, actually, quite a lot of the badminton land is open access. Quite a lot of these big feudal landowners of a more sensible attitude than, say, I mean, Dyson, for example. James Dyson, who's bought a lot of land near Yate and out near Hullabington in near Chippenham. He's got a whole airfield over there. He's got his security guards all over the place for thousands of acres, whereas a lot of the old traditional landowners, like the Batsford estate at Cirencester and the Badminton estate, and it's just towards Stroud kind of direction around that area, Chipping Sodbury, they have lots of open access land. One of the sort of things you come across a sign saying open access until sunset or something like that.
Well, I mean, the traditional, some of the traditional landowning classes, the aristocracy, you know, Tracy Worcester springs to my mind. They see giving access to people as part of, you know, the compact that they have with the rest of the society. Mm. But Richard Drax, for example, who owns the whole of Dorset and Barbados.
Well, not quite. Yeah.
Well, if you go down there, you will see he's got this massive wall behind which he lives.
Well, the right to roamers have been over that wall.
Well, I'm sure they have, but the point is they're determined that, you know, there's a lot of resistance from wealthier people who own property that which they do. But from the Labour Party's point of view, it's a vote winner. Yeah. And of course,
it's an open goal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But of course, and Starmer has to do something to show his restive troops that it isn't just, you know, we're not going to do anything to,
yeah, Blair
to make things.
Blair did something similar, didn't he, in 97, actually. There was a Right to Roam campaign back then, too. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Jonathan Moses from the Right to Roam campaign, who was doing the Skillshare this week.
My name is Jonathan Moses. I'm one of the national organisers of the Right to Roam campaign. We've just been doing a Skillshare workshop in Bristol, basically to teach people what their rights are when they're trespassing on private land, to give them the skills and the confidence to deal with confrontation if they're approached by landowners or gamekeepers or anyone like that, and also to teach them some basic mapping and research skills so that they can start telling stories about the land that they trespass on and what's going on those estates.
For most people, they don't want to trespass because they don't want to be shouted at by a farmer and maybe even have a gun tucked under their arm.
Well, that's the exact reason that we're doing these workshops, so that people have strategies in place that give them the confidence to deal with those situations and know where their rights are and where they stand.
Surely trespassing is illegal or lawful or something.
A common misconception. In fact, trespassing is at best only a civil offence, which means that in reality, landowners aren't going to be able to take you to court or really do anything about your presence on that land. It's only if you commit damage, use violence, or disrupt any lawful activity that you can get into criminal trouble. So trespass away, do it peacefully, do it freely, be happy.
You look like the sort of person that might have confronted a few landowners, or they may have confronted you in the past. What are those sort of encounters like in your experience?
I find them quite entertaining now, for the most part, but that's probably because I'm a, you know, more brazen, cocky sort of guy. But I would say that actually once they realise you're not going anywhere and that you've really stood your ground and asserted your rights, the whole kind of manner of the conversation can often change. And often you can find yourself having strange bits of agreement, even with the people that you're chatting to, or some common interests as well. So, you know, I ended up spending an hour arguing with the gamekeeper of the Englefield estate. But actually by the end of that conversation, we'd agreed on the birds that we like. We talked about some of the kind of protection issues that were going on in the countryside. We found a little bit of common ground. So you can be surprised by the sort of conversations you have.
And you can also maybe disagree. If they say they want you to leave in that direction, you might say, well, actually, my car is over that way.
Indeed. Exactly, yeah. So you can determine which direction you leave at any given moment. So you can happily kind of carry on the route that you've been going on anyway.
So how do people follow this stuff? I suppose it's all online these days, isn't it?
I'm afraid it is all online these days, yes. So if you go to righttoroam.org.uk, you can sign up to our mailing list there. We're also on Instagram, Twitter, all that good stuff as well. So that's the easiest way to get in touch with the campaign. We've also got a flowering network of local groups that are happening. So if you drop an email to righttoroam2020@gmail.com, get in touch with us there, tell us where you're based, and we'll see if we can put you in touch with any local activists.
There's been a lot of activity on Dartmoor. Can you just bring us up to date with how that's been going?
Yep, so the Dartmoor National Park Authority reached a kind of permissive agreement with the landowners, which has allowed, on a kind of provisional basis, people to wild camp, and I think up to 80% of the land that they were on before. We've said that's not good enough, that permissive rights are nothing like true rights to wild camp, so we pushed the National Park Authority to appeal the court decision. They've now unanimously agreed to appeal, so there's a crowdfunder going at the moment, run through the Dartmoor Preservation Association, that's to raise costs to help support the National Park Authority to revisit that case and hopefully get it overturned.
So that's that is Jonathan Moses' Right to Roam campaign. Well worth follow. He gave some sort of Gmail address there, but they are at the Right to Roam. It does sound as if this is kind of picking up. You were talking about Drax. They've been this was well attended as well. In fact, it was booked up, this Skillshare I managed to get to this week in Bristol. And the idea is, well, you can go out with confidence. And in fact, there seem to be a lot of young people who are getting quite into this idea of, well, I can go for a walk somewhere that I want to go, and if someone tries to confront me, well, I know what to say. I know the law better than they do, maybe even.
Well, I mean, it's, if there is a resurgence in this kind of attitude, well, that's good, isn't it? But of course, it's, you know, if we are tall, it's because we stand on the shoulders of giants. And the Kinder Scout trespass in the 1930s was obviously a very important Labour movement event. And don't forget that the socialist movement in the early part of the 20th century was built around things like rambling clubs and things of that sort, because it was regarded as healthy, and also, you know, you could talk politics and economics as you tramp through the countryside.
Well,
and all
I suppose the ultimate form of trespass is when you decide you're going to stay. In fact, you might even build yourself a camp and stay for a couple of years, which is what the likes of Goldie down at Save Stonehenge Heritage Action Project have done. This starts to bring in this idea of, well, if we're getting to the situation where it's becoming almost impossible for people to pay their rents, pay their mortgages, people are going to have to go somewhere. I did a video, must be nearly 5 years ago now, with Andy Worthington and Sean Carslake. Andy is the author of the book on the Battle of the Beanfield, and Sean was actually part of the Traveller Convoy. He was a mechanic on the Traveller Convoy in the 1980s, about a new traveller revolution, because people are simply realising, well, we need if we can't afford to pay the mortgage and pay the rent, we need somewhere to live. So we're either going to get a canal boat, or we're going to get ourselves a vehicle to live in.
Well, I mean, in the that sounds quite positive, but of course, in the United States of America, millions of people live in tent cities. In New York, they live in the sewers. People live in their cars. And that's because that's the way, that's what modern capitalism in its final phases looks like. And of course, we should encourage people, you know, we need a policy around this which recognises why people do this sort of stuff. But ultimately, of course, it's actually a symptom of failure.
I mean,
there are plenty of empty rooms and empty houses in this country.
I'm worried about
loads of space.
We've had 20 years, no, sorry, we've had 10 years or so of Help to Buy type schemes, haven't we, where young people are encouraged to take out mortgages. So now they've been told, well, not only are your wages not going to keep up with inflation, but your mortgage rates are now going up and the value of your house is going down.
Yes, and of course, Help to Buy ultimately just meant a subsidy to the property developers.
Well, that's right, Help to Sell.
Yes.
Really.
And of course, it was actually targeted at the swing voters. I mean, the Tories want to get people on the housing ladder because they think that's going to make them vote Tory. The problem is they can't get people onto the housing ladder because it's impossible, because of all the Tory voters already on the housing ladder don't want all these young people, you know, because the only way to do that is bring house prices down, and that's not what they want. But it's dysfunctional on every level. It's a dysfunctional housing policy, because I've always tried to stress it also leads to a dysfunctional economic policy, where if everything is invested in real estate and houses, conservatories, loft conversions, instead of small and medium enterprises which are producing new stuff. You know,
it's deliberate though, isn't it?
Well, yes, because there's a lot more money to be made from doing this than doing sensible stuff, and the people making the money, that it becomes in their interest to carry on with the same old policy.
One of the things I've certainly noticed in my lifetime is people who used to be, or the kinds of enterprise characters that used to start inventing better widgets, as you call it, Martin, now they just seem to be sitting pretty on these utilities where they don't have to actually do anything and the money just comes rolling in.
Well, it's all in your economics textbook. It's about super profits and normal profits. If you can make a super profit by investing in property or in drugs, I mean, that's one of the reasons why the drugs market functions like it does, because the super profits involved. And as soon as anybody's arrested, somebody's going to take over, because the amount of money you can make in a very short space of time is enormous. It's not so much on property, but it's still a one-way bet. But of course, what it means is that when a new startup is bidding for funds, they don't get much of a look in. Unless, of course, you are one of these tech startups, like FinTech, which crashed, which David Cameron was involved in, where in actual fact they've got no real product, and it's just a load of flimflam.
Isn't the oil industry actually running the whole show? You've got BP's annual profits this year doubled,
yeah,
to $28 billion. That's £23 billion. Profits, that is. And the previous week, it was $32.2 billion for Shell. These people are just raking it in.
Yeah, but
the rest of the people are scrabbling around to live.
Don't forget that the oil companies are owned by the banks, and the banks are owned by the wealthy shareholders. BlackRock seems to own virtually everything, and they are owned by Vanguard. Now,
who owns Vanguard?
Well, nobody knows, because it's a private company.
So that's clever, isn't it?
It is, yes. And of course, this is all in Marxist theory from the late 19th century.
Conglomo.
Yes,
we
it's
own
monopoly
you.
Capitalism. That's what it is. It's analysed by Rosa Luxemburg, Lenin, and various other people.
Well, they seem to be the only people. You can see why the government thinks, well, we ought to really leave BP and Shell alone, because at least they're making all these mega billions in profits, and we can claw a little bit of that profit off them.
No, I mean, they could have had a windfall tax on them, but they chose not to. They could nationalise them. Now,
Keir Starmer promised he wouldn't do that, didn't he, at the World Economic Forum.
That's right. So he's promised the bad guys that he ain't going to do anything nasty to them, which is why they're perfectly prepared to tolerate him. No Tony Benn he.
Mm. And in the meantime, it is possible to go and find yourself a little piece of land or live on it, as Goldie and his friends have done. They're part of a campaign against the tunnel down at Stonehenge, which has been going for God knows how long. It must be, oh gosh, I was working down there at the BBC in Southampton while Twyford Down was going on. Gosh, must be 1990. 1991, and the project is still there, although they've been doing extremely well through the courts to try and stop them digging up Wiltshire to make a massive tunnel for the A303.
My name's Goldie. I'm a member of Stonehenge Heritage Action Group, and we're currently at Stonehenge Heritage Action Camp, which is a camp in resistance to the Stonehenge Tunnel scheme, which, yeah, the long of the short is... Well, the short of the long version is that they want to build this ridiculous road tunnel underneath the Stonehenge World Heritage Site. And so there's been a protest camp here for the last 2 and a bit years.
Can you just describe this tunnel and why it is you oppose it?
So they're going to build a tunnel that's going to be between 2 and 3 kilometres. They haven't quite really decided what they're going to do yet. Depends on a lot of factors. That will go underneath the World Heritage Site. So there's also going to be an extra 2 roundabouts and a motorway, like an A-road viaduct that leads off the end of it. And they're also going to expand the current bit of road and widen the current roundabout called Countess Roundabout. And this is because the traffic gets really, really bad. And so we're on a bit of road that's kind of like the main route down to Devon and Cornwall. And it's part of like a wider scheme. So there's like a proposal of like 8 different bits of the A303 that they want to widen, but only two or three of them have been funded.
Well, one of the weird things about here is you have a kind of a rush hour, don't you? You have a Friday night when all the Londoners come down to their little cottages out in Cornwall and Devon, and you also on a Sunday night too. So is that true? You have a kind of rush hour on the 303 next door?
There is definitely, like, the road gets really quiet, and it's not because there's no cars, it's because they're all just, like, at a standstill. And it's really clear that the traffic's a problem, but we know from, like, research that building roads and widening roads just creates the need for more traffic because more people depend on it. And, like, what we actually need is not just building more roads. Like, we've been doing that since the Roman times, and it's kind of getting old now. What we actually need is more radical solutions to these problems. We need to localise our food network so there's less haulage. We need people to work from home or to have shorter working weeks. We need better public transport infrastructure. Like, all of the people who work for the trains are on strike. Like, they're not getting paid properly. That is making more people have to drive or have to rely on cars, and it's just not sustainable. It's not the radical solutions that we need to all of these wider problems in society as well.
It works quite nicely for the oil companies, doesn't it, that people can't get on their train to work anymore.
An investment in roads is just an investment in the fossil fuel industry, absolutely.
Okay, so are you actually on the route here of the proposal? Are you in the way, or are you near? Because you're right next to the road, aren't you? It must be actually a bit of a horrid place to live, right next to a massive dual carriageway.
It's definitely helped me build empathy with all of the animals that also live next to the road and like live within the World Heritage Site. And yeah, the kind of fact that we live really close to Stonehenge is like a bit of a novelty, I'm not going to lie. But yeah, we believe that the bit of, so we're in a bit of woodland and there's also a bit of hard standing, a bit of concrete, and they want to use that bit of concrete as the site for one of their first machinery compounds for like storing vehicles and stuff. So yeah, I'd say that we're pretty in the way. We have a weird relationship with National Highways, in that they're kind of acknowledging that we're here, but they're not really doing anything about it yet. And so we've been able to like have a very well established community over the past couple of years that we've been here and been working a lot on like that sort of internal workings of how an off-grid community can run.
Well, this is the problem. A lot of people like their creature comforts. What would you say to anyone thinking, well, I would go and join them, I agree with the protest, but I need my creature comforts?
You can have them. I think also the idea of like comfortability is definitely a part of this wider system issue, like system problem. A lot, like all of the conveniences that we have come at the expense of exploiting other people. Like, you know, I would really love to be able to like drive to the shops and stay warm in my car while I'm doing that, but that's actually just not something that like I as a human being deserve to have, really.
Well, a lot of people would say they don't have the time to even, you know, walk to the shops. Their time is under extreme pressure and they want to use any spare time, maybe with their family, that sort of thing, rather than walking to the shops in the cold.
I absolutely agree, and I can empathise. Like, there's nothing more that people deserve than to be able to spend more time with their families. But we live in a system that doesn't allow people that, and so, you know, for our children to be able to spend time with their families in the future, then we need to actually push for system change that means that we're not working 5 days a week for 50 hours. You know, that we're not breaking our backs just to like put a roof over our heads. I think what this community is offering is like an alternative to that, like being able to like not have to work and be able to actually, or like not to work to get money, but to work for actual rewarding things and investments in our future, such as building our own homes or fostering these communities that are long lasting.
Okay, so you've actually done quite well, really. Not necessarily you on your own, but the campaign, the wider campaign to stop the tunnel and to stop this massive investment in the A303, haven't you?
There's a lot of different groups that are involved in this, and they're sort of attacking the tunnel project from many different angles. So we are sort of like the FINT-led, so FINT stands for female, intersex, non-binary and trans, like element of that, that's kind of spawned out of like all of the different direct action groups that are happening in the country. And we sort of like see ourselves as like leading on from, as we were talking about just before this podcast, like about the 90s road protests and the Newbury bypass, and like we kind of see those groups as like our ancestors in a way, as well as the ancestors of all of the people who have lived on this land for thousands of years. There's the Stonehenge Alliance, who have done a very successful legal battle against Highways England and really called into question the eligibility and the lawfulness of this project to continue. There's other groups that are involved as well. There's groups that focus more on like the spiritual connection that the land holds, and our relationship with that. There's also a group who's like pro-tunnel, but you know, they actually have some really, really valid concerns, because they're right, the traffic is really bad and we do need some sort of changes. I just don't think that they've come to the correct solution, that we just need to widen the road.
It's funny, isn't it? If you go back, say, 40, 50 years, some of us around here might be able to remember, if someone was going from Devon and Cornwall to London, they'd almost certainly have been using the train in those days. But look, there has been a court decision as well, hasn't there, in 2022, which has actually gone in your favour. I was quite amazed to see that this has put a big spanner in the works for the Department for Transport.
So the highways in the Stonehenge Alliance took National Highways to court over this, and basically were arguing that they haven't really considered many options. They've just kind of said, we're going to build a tunnel. That's what we're going with. And they said, hold up a second. This isn't, you know, financially, economically, like, environmentally viable. This is unlawful. This is damaging. And the High Court said, you know what? You're right. They need to go back and think about this some more. And so that's kind of one of the most recent delays. But a lot of people will say, like, oh, the tunnel's never going to go ahead. Like, they've been talking about this for ages. And it's like, yes, you're right. It's because of campaign groups like us that it's been delayed for so long, for decades and decades. And so I kind of see our role in that as to just sort of, like, continue that fight. And also, even if it's up in the air for even longer, like, we're still buying, like, chunks of time for the wildlife around here and for, you know, all of the people who enjoy this landscape.
Almost the first thing that we talked about when we arrived was HS2. Do you see yourself as something similar to that? And what other kind of protests like this are there around the country?
A lot of the folks who are involved in this campaign have also had some involvement with HS2. and have kind of joined this space as like a sort of next step in terms of resisting infrastructure projects. I think we are a part of a bigger struggle. Anybody who's resisting construction or gentrification or infrastructure development anywhere in the world is a part of this wider struggle. It's all, at the end of the day, the same sort of things that we're fighting against, both capitalism and like the patriarchal domination of people and of nature, particularly of Mother Nature. And that's really kind of like, yeah, that's really kind of important that we see those connections, because we can't do this on our own. There are other sort of direct action, like environmental campaigns going on around the country, other protest camps as well. Some protest camps that I want to mention is like Faslane up in Scotland. So they're resisting like the nuclear bases up there. And there's also Coldean Arc, which I haven't visited, but one of our comrades went there recently, and it's a group of people down in Brighton who are resisting a development and putting a lot of work into looking after the land and restoring the land as well.
Finally, what would you say to anyone listening who's thinking, well, these are just young people standing in the way of progress?
Absolutely. You are correct. The idea of having endless progress and endless capital accumulation and expansion is not reasonable and not sustainable and not conducive to a future where we have a livable planet. I would say that like this is like these young people, it's not necessarily young people either, like are making an investment in their future at the end of the day, which, you know, if any good capitalist should be proud of them, really, for doing that. I think that there is a definite power within the youth, and that's not just to say that the power is with young people, but for anybody with a youthful attitude who thinks that they can make a change by standing up to something. And that's definitely something that we should be fostering, and is definitely something that this country like needs more of.
Well, it's certainly an alternative to going to university and having a massive debt, learning something that has got dubious use at the end of it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I know a few people who have gone to university and become very disillusioned by being within those institutions and within those systems that, you know, it has a damaging impact on your mental health to sit in a box all day so that you can go and, you know, have the right tickets to go and sit in more boxes. And so I'm really glad that I've chosen to do this and invest in my future instead of doing those things. Before I was doing activism, I was doing an art foundation course, and just wasn't a great time, I'm not going to lie.
It sounds to me like you're almost continuing that here.
Well, yeah, this is like an environment that I think like nourishes creativity as well. Like, I've definitely been able to make some really nice artwork here and have lots of interesting experiences that I just wouldn't have if I was stuck in that system. Putting a lot of time into coming up with creative solutions for like how we get food or how we get water, for example, or how we solve conflict. All of these are things that we're going to need in the future, and they're definitely things that you don't get taught in schools.
Okay, Goldie from Save Stonehenge Camp, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's Goldie there. I just found his turn of phrase pretty encouraging, and also this whole idea that progress is not necessarily a good idea.
Well, it depends what you mean by it, doesn't it?
Well, it's quite obvious what the system means by it, yeah. By the Babylonian system, whatever you want to call it. It means growth, economic growth.
Yeah, but the idea that I think ultimately we may get to a steady state economy, you know, I'm trying to remember that Hermann Kohl, is it? I can't remember the name of the guy who first came up with the idea. But in the shorter term, the reality is that the economy has to keep moving and changing, because we've still got lots of poverty, and the poverty is the as a result of the maldistribution of resources and so on and so forth. You can't condemn people living in poverty in developing countries.
Hermann Daly?
Daly, that's the one.
D-A-L-Y?
Yeah. And I think there has been a big debate about whether economic growth, because, of course, a lot of economic growth is illusionary, because the GDP figures include all sorts of things. So if you have a train crash, then you have to spend a load of money sorting out the train crash. That all gets added to GDP as production.
Well, okay, I mean, you talk quite a lot about free public transport from time to time here, didn't you? So, for example, if public transport is free in Belarus or wherever, in some city.
In Tallinn,
wherever it happens to be, or in Seattle, as I believe it was at one point, or yeah. Sheffield, as it nearly was at one point. This is not so much economic activity, and it registers as a downer on the economic system.
No. What actually happens with that is the money, you have to subsidise it, okay? So if you have to subsidise it 100%, so all of that subsidy gets counted as GNP.
Yeah, but it's nowhere near as much as, say, a First Group were running it, or a private company. They're going to be charging double, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, but at the same time, the externalities of having free public transport are that you make the environment more livable and therefore more investable.
Well, you're making my argument for me. If it's cheaper and if it's provided for free, say for example like the water service used to be, many of these utilities, the economists will look at it and say, oh no, this is no good because look, the GDP's gone down.
No, if you look at what Michael Hudson's saying, is if you provide the basics for free or at very low subsidized prices, it allows the widget makers to get on and do their bit. Yeah.
But actually, the widget makers are a threat to the monopolies, aren't they?
Well, not necessarily.
They are, yeah,
No, it depends, Tony, because there's actually arguments about how industrial strategy should be functioned. Because small, medium enterprises, they're a very important part of the economy, but they're often subcontractors to bigger producers. And it's actually about having a planned economy. That's why I'm a socialist. I don't think that we're actually going to get a livable economy by everybody just down on the land and knitting their own yogurt.
Go back to Goldie's vision there for a minute, because he's talking about very, very sensible stuff like localised food. We should not be shipping the food right around the world. We shouldn't be even shipping it right across the country.
Well, I agree with that to some extent, but we don't grow bananas in this country, and if we want to eat them, we're going to have to bring them in from somewhere.
Well, we're not talking about bananas, we're talking about cabbages.
All right, well, okay. Now, I'm all in favour of trying to get more localised food production, but that implies intervention in the economy. So, for example, the trade deals...
Well, jacking up fuel prices, that will force people to have local food, won't it?
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And it may happen anyway, because if you get a massive crash, people are forced... I mean, when I lived in Eastern Europe... people would go out in the autumn and they would strip the hedgerows bare of all fruits because they were poor. And that's what they did. We've stopped the people
find people doing that in the war here, for example.
Yes, indeed. And therefore, that necessity being the mother of invention, that's the sort of thing that
happens. Not very good for GDP, that. It's all free, isn't it?
Yes, well, it doesn't show up on GDP.
No.
Now, the point is about economic growth is what it measures is what it measures. And therefore, you've got to be sceptical about what it actually is. But nevertheless, technical change is actually explosive at the moment. This is the thing that capitalism does. It revolutionises the means of production through the application of technology,
which can also be extremely destructive,
of course.
I think what he's saying in a nutshell there is, look, if you have a low GDP lifestyle like he does, then actually your quality of life can be immensely more.
Well, as I've said previous week on this show, Kerala in southern India has a much higher quality of life than Bangladesh, even though their GDP per head is low, because they organise themselves, they get their priorities right, basically, healthcare first, food production, local food production, very much part of what they're about. But at the same time, Kerala wants to grow. People in Kerala have aspirations. They want to improve the situation. They don't want to live permanently in poverty. And of course, they have a dignified poverty. It's what in Latin America they talk about the difference between poverismo and what's the other one? Indignidad. Yeah, you can be poor and dignified, or you can live without dignity in poverty. Yeah, and that's what's most intolerable. And economic change will have to happen through the redistribution of resources from wealthy, powerful people to less powerful
people.
And that is actually good for economic growth.
The question is whether people have land and whether people have wealth. It's very, very simple. And we seem to be going into a society, it's been happening since the 1980s, particularly into a society that actually makes it beneficial for anybody to exploit others and in fact rewards them and gives them more and more wealth. It's a totally perverse system and completely upside down, because you end up with a completely landless underclass. And now, of course, many of those people who were conned or convinced to take out mortgages over the last 10 years are now thinking, crikey, I'm going to have to get rid of my house, and it won't actually possibly be worth as much as what it was when I bought it.
Well, yes, I mean, but don't forget, for many people, the negative equity is...
Debt. Back to Tony Benn and debt again,
of course, it's all about debt, yes. But don't forget, the negative equity affects the people on the lower rungs of the property ladder. people on the higher rungs, the Duke of Westminster may probably on the top rung in our country, they will lose some money in a property crash, but they'll still have a hell of a lot more than when they started, which is why they like the system as it is, and they don't want to change it.
Okay, we're going to penultimate item before the break. Got to talk, obviously, about this horrific earthquake in Turkey and Syria this week. Martin, the death toll over the last hour or so has risen to 22,765 confirmed dead, as anger is growing, apparently, over the Syria rescue response. Three people were rescued from the rubble of a building in the Syrian city of Jubla. State media reported around 110 hours after a deadly earthquake struck on Monday. But the there is a lot of people around the world are sort of looking in on this, journalists particularly, this is The Guardian, and saying, well, you haven't responded to this well enough. Well, if you had a look at some of the footage and the coverage of it, in Turkey, the commentators there were saying, well, these buildings were designed for an earthquake, they thought, pretty good, that could only happen once every 20,000 years. The only thing was, it was a bigger earthquake than that.
Yes, and there are some things which are beyond human control. But of course, in the situation in Turkey and Syria, we've had an ongoing war started by the Western deep state in 2011, which has led to all sorts of problems. And the northern part of Syria, where this earthquake has hit most strongly, is still under Al-Qaeda control, supported by our special forces, which is why and of course, Syria itself is under sanctions. So any attempt to try and help people in Syria is, you'd have thought, because there's been an earthquake, you might say, well, let's lift the sanctions on Syria. Oh, not a bit of it. And, of course, guess who's come out of the woodwork in the middle of all of these rescues? The White Helmets.
Oh, yes.
They're there, rescuing people, like they do. And that's why we must give more money to overthrow Assad, get Al-Qaeda in power in Damascus, and all of these human crises are, would be there anyway, are made much worse by the political crisis which is overlying all of it. Yeah, Syria is a wreck because we wrecked it, and the earthquake's just the cherry on the cake. Far more people have been killed in the war in Syria than have been killed in this earthquake. But the earthquake don't help, does it?
Oh, it certainly doesn't. But what do you think about the finger-pointing over the response? Because I've been looking at that thinking, well, it's all very well for us to point the finger. And also, it's good to see that the Bristol Muslim community particularly have gotten centres together where people can donate sleeping bags, blankets, tents, things like that. And they are busing them to Heathrow and getting them over there.
Yeah, well, I think the problem in northern Syria is it's still a war zone. So it's very difficult to move things around. You know, it's not settled. In Turkey itself, there's an election coming up, and Erdogan has to seem to be responding, you know, in an orderly fashion to this and helping people, otherwise he might lose the election. But, you know, obviously, people's hearts go out when something like this happens. But I'm afraid to say that the daily grind of oppression, poverty and violence, which many people live in this planet, hardly ever makes the news, even though it's a daily toil.
Well, there's been spying on journalists in the UK. We covered this briefly last week, but it came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week. And have a listen very carefully to the answer to the question at Prime Minister's Questions, because remember, at Prime Minister's Questions, you're supposed to answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Big Brother Watch recently released a report into unaccountable government bodies such as the Counter Disinformation Unit, the Rapid Response Unit and the British Army's 77th Brigade. We've seen huge swathes of public money being spent recording political dissent on social media under the guise of tackling misinformation. Politicians, including myself, the Leader of the Opposition, academics, activists and journalists and even members of public have been subjected to monitoring by Whitehall officials. This at the same time as we're waiting for the reporting of the Pitchford inquiry into questionable state surveillance on campaigns like the Stephen Lawrence campaign. So can the Prime Minister tell us how much public money is spent on these units and whether he thinks it's a justifiable thing to do in our democracy to spend public money in this manner? And could you also update the House on the progress of the Pitchford inquiry?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I have to get back to the Honourable Lady on the Pitchford inquiry and indeed to give her an exact figure. But in general, I think certainly I on this side of the House believe very strongly in free speech, and we'll make sure that we continue to protect it wherever we can.
Yes, well, whenever we can. And by the way, I'll get back to you on the Pitchford inquiry. That's completely ground to a halt, isn't it? This is the inquiry into the police hacking people's lives, having kids with them and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's who was the MP that made the question? We don't know. Well, I mean, thankfully somebody is raising what a Brigade 77 up to in the House of Commons, because that's a really big question. Because the problem with all of this is that we spend money on the intelligence services, Brigade 77 and all the rest of it, and then they use that money to control the political debate that we're allowed to have and to get rid of the people they don't want. It's quite clear the Integrity Initiative were definitely determined to get rid of, you know, they were attacking Jeremy Corbyn behind the scenes, and that's paid for by the taxpayer. And of course, we don't really live, I mean, the idea that we live in a democracy where everybody gets a fair say is clearly just not the case. It never was. It still isn't.
Just on the topic of investigative journalism at The Guardian, Dan Sabah, defence and security editor, has got an interesting article a couple of weeks ago on the National Security Bill. He says it may have a chilling effect on investigative journalism in Britain. Guy Black, deputy chair of Telegraph Newspapers, says the draft legislation sets too low a bar on what constitutes spying. The UK's they'll be turning us into spies next, Martin, won't they? The UK's proposed National Security Bill could have a chilling effect on investigative journalism because it sets too low a bar on what constitutes spying. The House of Lords were told by Guy Black that he was concerned for the draft legislation could criminalise reporters and whistleblowers because it says simply that a crime is committed if it may materially assist a foreign intelligence service. A Conservative peer highlighted a string of investigations he feared could be at risk, including the Panama Papers, published by The Guardian and others, which revealed how the global rich exploit secretive offshore tax regimes.
Well, I think that you've got various levels of this onion to peel back, haven't you?
This is about, surely, it's about these foreign conflicts, say, for example, with China, with Iran, with Russia. If people are putting a pro-Russian point of view, as we do quite a lot often do, or pro-Iran point of view, or pro-China point of view, as you regularly do, that could be seen as aiding a foreign intelligence service, potentially.
It certainly could. And don't forget, they've also given themselves that the intelligence services, the police and the army, can carry out any illegal act and not be held accountable for it. They've passed that law. This is the whole purpose of everything that's been going on since 9/11 and Operation Gladio in the 1970s and 1980s is the deep state creating a totalitarian fascist, and let's call it fascist because that's what it is, state, so that they can take on their enemies as they see it in Russia and China. I mean, we're there. We've arrived. And of course, we've obviously been covering this in the second part. But you know, it's these kind of plandemics, wars, and all the rest of it are the classic plays of oligarchies to seize power. It's all in Aristotle, and you know, we're staring it in the face. We're staring down the barrel of a gun as we speak.
So before we have our break. Thank you, everyone, by the way, for sending in poems since Christmas. We had a few Christmas poems, and then people started sending them in, various of them. One here from, well, I'm not sure it's from, but it's about, it's about New Zealand. It says, "Adern is gone, fake tear in eye. She says she lacks the strength to try. Push back the truth anymore and wants to take her kids out more. Get married, love, and live her life away from all the deaths and strife that she has caused in New Zealand land with help from Schwab, her vile main man. Young Goebbel leader she was trained to be. TB, Ghoul, Blair, his protege. Alas, too late, her evil done. Deny the truth and have some fun. Spend the stash of gains ill-got. Stage right, memoirs, a life of rot." That was quite, I think, rather wonderful. But another before the break. Best memory systems. Thanks. I mean, I just encourage people to do send these poems in. If it's good enough, we'll read it out. The best memory system. Forget each kindness that you do the moment you have done it. Forget the praise that falls to you the moment you have won it. Forget the slander that you hear before you can repeat it. Forget each slight, each spite, each sneer whenever you may meet it. Remember every kindness done to you, whatever its measure. Remember praise by others won, and pass it on with pleasure. Remember those who lend you aid, and be a grateful debtor. Remember every promise made and keep it to the letter. Remember all the happiness that comes to you in living. Forget each worry and distress. Be happy and forgiving. Remember good, remember truth. Remember heaven's above you. And you will find through age and youth that many hearts will love you. By Alfred Beardsley.
He was in agony when he prayed in Gethsemane. For the price was to pay seemed too much for him. He contemplated the price to be paid for humanity. And even the Almighty turned his back at him. They used to love to stay with the master, but now they considered him a disaster. The ones who cried, Hosanna, Hosanna, same ones who led him straight to Golgotha. Judas was too quick to betray him. Peter couldn't wait to deny him. The world at large would reject him. Tell me what you wanna do to him. But why didn't the Jews know he's the King of Kings? When even the stars and the kings know he's the King of Kings. The sun and the moon was his authority, because he told them once and they be standing still. They hung him high, stretched him wide. He hung his head and then he died. But that's not how the story ends. And but the heroes again.
Jesus Christ the Son of.
Why do you seek for the living among the dead? Do he die like a lamb but he's still not dead? Cause even in the grave he's not over death. Now we have the victory over death. I see an angel of the Lord come down from heaven. He rolled us to the world like a little pebble. Oh, we think of glory.
Lord, God's strong and mighty.
We are roses. Where is our victory?
We are roses.
Where is our sting?
We are roses.
No longer in the grave.
They hung him high, stretched him wide. He hung his head and then he died. That's not how the story ends. And but of the heroes again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
When the sun refused to shine upon this awful scene, and humanity has lost hope, because all they saw was the cross and his bleeding victim. Their future seemed to be darkened with despair as they watched him laid in the tomb, hands folded on his breast, his eyes shut and his lips singing forever silent. They watched as a heavy stone was rolled against the entrance of a tomb, and a guard of 100 soldiers around his sepulchre. Permit me to say, Jesus was very dead, but that was not how the story ended. For 3 days later, early Sunday morning, there was a mighty earthquake, for an angel of the Lord has descended from the heavens, his eyes as lightning, and his raiment as white as snow. For the fear of him, the gods did shake and fall down like dead men. Brave soldiers that have never been afraid of human power, taking captives without sword or spear. For the face that they beheld today was not the face of a mortal warrior, but the face of the captain of the Lord's army, the power of his resurrection. They watched as he rolled away the heavy stone, as one who rolled away a tiny pebble, and Jesus stepped out of the grave proclaiming, "Oh death, where is thy sting? Oh grave, where is thy victory? Open up your gates and let the King of Glory come on in." Who is the King of Glory? He's the Lord God, strong and mighty. Who is the King of Glory? The one of these kings of peace. That's
the end. I'm not of the heroes again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Yes, oh yes. Hallelujah.
So that's Orbital from 2001, Doctor Who. And before that, Jesus Christ, the Son of God is the sort of way I found the song. But actually, it's called The Resurrection Song, 2021 from Samsung, Samsong. And welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, on the new Talk Radio. Well, not so new. I keep saying that, don't I? Talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, as well as at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. So with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Now, Martin, just in the break there, we were chatting a bit about Roger Waters. Do you want to start by saying what he's been up to? Because as a Pink Floyder, the other lot have kind of turned on him, and he's been at the UN sort of representing Russia, amazingly.
The Russians invited him to address the UN, and he accepted.
Security Council?
General
Assembly?
I think it was the UN Security Council, actually. And he made a plea for negotiations in the Ukraine, and
the other Pink Floyders didn't like it.
Well, Dave Gilmour and put together a single to support Ukraine, and of course Bono and others went to actually jam with Zelensky in the Kiev underground and all the rest of it. You can see various people are jumping in various directions here. It's extraordinary how easily led people are. Because I bet you, if you asked a lot of these people that have been waving Ukrainian flags anything serious about Ukrainian politics, they wouldn't have a clue. It's not the sort of thing that most people have taken any interest in until they were told to.
Yes, he called for a ceasefire, Roger did, and condemned Russia's illegal invasion, but also denounced provocateurs in the West who he claimed were responsible. Ukrainian Ambassador Sergei Kalitska called Waters' speech another brick in the wall of Russian disinformation. That's the Ukrainians. So they don't like it, even though he's saying, come on, we've really got to have peace talks and we've got to get a peace here.
Yeah, I mean, he stuck his neck out. That's an honourable position. The Russians would say, we are prepared to have a ceasefire, but you've got to listen to what our demands are, which include the secession of the republics which
invaded
us. He's
making it clear. He's saying the invasion of Ukraine was illegal, but he's also saying it was not unprovoked. I condemn the provocateurs in the strongest possible terms.
Well, he's moved his position on this. Yeah. In actual fact, as Scott Ritter well knows, it's not necessarily illegal at all because it's under R2P. And don't forget that the Donbass republics in 2014 voted to secede from the Ukraine and that you are allowed to do that in international law. That's why Kosovo is no longer part of Serbia.
So rather,
much to the disgust of many people in Serbia, but there you are.
Rather than representing the official view of Russia in any way, the musician said he was speaking on behalf of the 4 billion or so brothers and sisters, the majority of the Earth's population that want an end to the war.
Well, that's the position of the rest of the world, is that we really don't need this, and they don't necessarily blame the Russians entirely for what's come about.
He's just about to go on tour. His gigs in Poland have been cancelled because of this.
Well, he's also on the death list put out by the peace list, as it's called, in Ukraine, various people of which have been assassinated.
I mean, it's someone calling for peace and actually criticising the Russians, it seems incredible that the Ukrainians are laying into him.
Well, that's because they're very cocky. At least in public pronouncements, the reality on the ground is much less, much different from what they pretend. But no doubt we will come on to that.
Why is it that some of his other Pink Floyd members, such as the guitarist, what's his name?
Gilmour.
Dave Gilmour has been criticising Roger
Waters.
I
mean, people are going to have different views about stuff, aren't they? I mean, that's normal if you think about it. But don't forget that
I think he does represent. When he says, I want an end to this war, he criticises both sides. He says, come on, let's have an end to the war. Surely, I mean, his musician friends can get behind him. He does represent billions of people in that view.
Well, he does. Don't forget, there are plenty of people in the West of supposedly liberal opinions who want to fight to the finish in the Ukraine because they see it as a matter of principle, blah, blah, blah,
blah,
blah. By
the way, Dave Gilmour, although it's not the lead guitarist of Pink Floyd, Sid Barrett was the original lead guitarist.
Well,
I don't know if he's
right.
No longer
well,
with us, but he made the band's name, didn't he? Sid did.
But in actual fact, Dave Gilmour captured the name Pink Floyd, so he carried on touring as Pink Floyd when Roger Waters had fallen out. They fell out years ago. You know what I mean? It's not as if they've... I mean, that's why there is no Pink Floyd now, because they all fell out.
Anyway,
presumably over things like this, you know.
Yeah, so Roger is touring. Meanwhile, in the British Parliament, we have all sorts of discussions about the Ukraine war, led by the questions led by Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition, leader of the Labour Party.
Every time Putin has been appeased, he's been back for more.
Exactly.
And so does the Prime Minister agree with me that across this House we must speak with one voice and say this terrible conflict must end with the defeat of Putin in Ukraine?
Yes.
Mr. Speaker, our objective remains to ensure a Ukrainian victory in this conflict. Vladimir Putin's aggression cannot be seen in any way to have been successful, and that's why we have accelerated and increased our support militarily for Ukraine this year. It's a decision that I took as Prime Minister. Today we are going even further, not just having provided Challenger tanks and being one of the first countries to do so, which catalysed the provision of tanks from other nations as well, but also today to move to start training Ukrainian Marines in the advanced capabilities they will need to mount further offensive, but also to train their pilots on advanced combat aircraft. So the House can be reassured we will continue to support Ukraine to ensure decisive military victory on the battlefield this year.
Yes, Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, can I welcome the additional support the Prime Minister has outlined today?
Well, I listen to that with despair, because what it means is that there is no serious debate about anything that's happened over the last year. Nothing. The idea that there is going to be some kind of military victory for the Ukraine is absurd. It isn't going to happen, just as Serbia is not going to retake Kosovo. Because if they try to retake Kosovo, NATO would smash them. So they're not going to try. And the same thing will be true in the Ukraine. And there could have been a deal. There was a deal on the table in March last year. Zelensky was talking directly to the rebel leadership and also with the Russians, and they had a deal on the table ready to go based on the Minsk agreements, which were passed as the Minsk agreements in 2014 and 2015 were supposed to settle it. And the UN Security Council agreed that the Minsk agreements were the basis for settling the dispute. But that was all ripped up, and Zelensky was willing to go back to the Minsk agreements, and guess who went to Kyiv to tell him not to? Boris Johnson.
One voice.
So Britain has actually paid
in stirring the conflict in Ukraine. Keir Starmer, the leader of the so-called leader of the opposition, is patting Boris on the back. He's also patting Rishi Sunak on the back. He's saying, we speak with one voice across the Houses of Parliament or in the House of Commons that this must only end with the defeat of Putin in Ukraine. But it's not going to, is it? It's delusory.
It's delusory. And, of course, it reminds me of, you know, political debates in the 19th century. There was similar unanimity about the Crimean War. Not that Britain had any business in the Crimea, but we felt we did. And, of course, it's a delusion that Britain has, that we are important and we can defeat Russia and that we are a big world power and that the Russians are quaking in their boots, that we're going to supply all this dribs and drabs of military equipment. Well, you know, what might happen because of this stupidity is the Russians may pick up the gauntlet and say, if you want to go to war with us, we're going to war with you. Mm. Are you ready?
Well, they certainly seem confident enough. And listening to, I haven't actually got a clip of it, but one of this thing called the Scott Ritter Show, where he's talking to military analysts in Russia, and they're saying, well, look, you know, we are ready to go up to full-scale war. Well, obviously, we don't really want to, but we're ready, and that's why we went into the Ukraine, is because we know that we can follow through if necessary here. We've not gone in there lightly. We've gone in there reluctantly, but we've thought it through.
Well, they have. They clearly have. I mean, the real game changer was that the whole thing, the provocation by the deep state in the West, was so that they could put sanctions on Nord Stream 2, sanctions on Russia, crash the Russian economy, as they imagined, and then the people would rise up from their food bank queues and all the rest of it and overthrow Putin. Hasn't worked out like that at all.
So what do you make of the news this week from Seymour Hersh that the US was behind the destruction of the Nord Stream 2 back last year?
Well, I sent you the email. As soon as it came out, I think I saw it 5 hours after it had come out. And, of course, let's just explain to the audience who Seymour Hersh is. He is the most senior US investigative journalist. He cut his teeth and made his reputation on the exposure of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam.
But you know what? He was working on domestic stories, too.
Oh,
and
yes.
He exposed the activities of the mafia working very closely with the police in Chicago, too,
yes,
didn't
well,
he?
Yes, well, that's where he came from, Chicago. So he was a tough Chicago reporter.
He was
before
a fantastic journalist,
well,
really.
He still
at
is.
International stuff
he
and,
still is.
And domestic.
He still
stuff.
Is.
And he had fantastic contacts.
Yes.
And any whistleblowers knew, if you can get to Seymour Hersh, he might actually
well,
get this out.
What's interesting about the article, and I encourage people to read it, is somebody on the inside has told him exactly how the Nord Stream 2 pipelines and the Nord Stream 1 pipelines were blown up.
Go on, then.
So, okay, let's, for the benefit of the audience who haven't read the article, every year they have something called Baltops exercises in the Baltic Sea, where NATO,
they being NATO, yeah,
NATO warships have a big exercise.
And
every
the Baltic
year.
States, I mean, between
yeah,
about Denmark
yeah,
and
that's
people
right,
like
yeah,
this,
yeah, they do it every year, and it happened this last year, as always. But there was a particularly big capital ship that went there, the USS Kearsage, which normally that's the biggest US ship that's ever been in the Baltic, so that was a bit unusual. But what the insider says is that the Kearsage is actually geared up to do the job of bombing the pipeline. So it's actually quite a lot involved in it. They
it's an amphibious assault ship, the Kearsage, and it's spelt for any nerds out there that want to have a look at this ship, USS Kearsage, K-E-A-R-S-A-R-G-E.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm just doing it off the top of my head. So anyway, to cut a long story short, they put explosives around the pipelines, which was actually quite a big job because they're fairly substantial, these pipelines. You know, they're designed not to be blown up, you know, or to get accidentally damaged. So they had to dig around them, and it's fairly deep water. So, but there was no apparently there's no big tidal problems. So they had to, but one of the very significant things in the article is it appears that the orders came from Biden's office to do this.
Well, that's funny, isn't it? Because he actually was bragging about being behind it
that's
as well,
right.
Wasn't he?
And of course, this very last week, Victoria Nuland said, well, I think we can all be happy that the Nord Stream pipelines are now junk at the bottom
so
of the Baltic Sea.
So the Americans decide that they're going to come over and blow up a pipeline between Germany and Russia in Europe. What the hell are they playing at?
Well, this is one of the major goals of the Ukraine war. It's to prevent Germany and Russia getting together and having a constructive relationship, and then, of course, being friends with China, because it's all economy, money, you know, everybody wants to make a way in the world. That would be the end of the Anglo-Zionist Empire. That's why they've got to stop it. And at one stage, they were trying to block the Nord Stream 2 pipeline using, you know, we're going to sanction you and all the rest of it. Then they accepted it, but that's because they knew that they were going to provoke a war in the Ukraine, which then gave them the next... You see, it is still an act of war, though, because what the guy in the article said, well, it was discussed at the highest levels, and this guy obviously was in these meetings, that this is illegal, and if we get caught for this, we're going to be in real trouble.
Well, the State Department has seen fit to deny these allegations.
Well, that doesn't mean anything, does it?
No.
As Mandy Rice Davis famously said, they would say that, wouldn't they?
So I'll put a link up on our show page.
I mean,
page.
What's happened in Germany is that Peter Frank, who's the investigator, has come out and said, well, there's no evidence that the Russians did it. And of course there isn't, because they wouldn't have
that
a motive.
That actually was what the BBC said the day it happened. Russians have blown up their own pipeline, if you can believe that.
Yeah, well, that means that's a false flag, Tony, and we all know that false flags don't exist. Conspiracy theorists believe in false flags.
Anyway,
and it just shows how
Republican Senator Mike Lee has said we can't rule out the US blew this up. The senator was commenting on Seymour Hersh's report and said his colleagues were never briefed on the attack. He said on Twitter he can't immediately rule out the idea the US blew up the Nord Stream pipeline that connects Russia and Germany. His comments came after veteran investigative journalist Seymour Hersh published an explosive report, that detailed how the US sabotaged the pipelines with the cooperation of Norway. Now, the Norwegians aren't really known for their belligerence against Russia, although they're a bit further away from Russia than Sweden or Finland, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I think what's happened in this particular case is that the Norwegians, because don't forget, because of the North Sea, they've got quite a lot of expertise in things like pipelines and so on. So they were brought into the game. This is all in the article. I mean, I can't summarize it all. And of course, if you were going to do something where this is, the Norwegians are the nearby, you know, they're the go-to team to do it. But according to Hirsch, is that they didn't actually plant the bombs. That was planted by US Navy divers from Florida, but they were on the ship. Yeah, they came to the ship. They're not normally on that ship, but they came there and they planted the bombs. But the bombs were on a timer so that the Americans could...
Surely it's remote control.
But the remote control is in the article... was by a Norwegian plane that dropped a sonar buoy into just above the explosive charges to make them blow up.
Right.
Okay.
So it wasn't quite a timer, but it was a remote control thing.
But
according to
Hirsch's
report,
in other words, they could then control when it went up, because they wanted all of their ships to be out of the Baltic Sea by the time it went up, because otherwise it would be absolutely obvious. I mean, they could have blown it up while they were there.
The White House didn't see fit to ask Congress whether it was going to blow up a Russian pipeline in Europe. According to Hirsch's report, which cites a source with direct knowledge of the planning, Congress didn't need to be notified of the plan to blow up the pipeline because it was downgraded from being a covert operation. The reason it was downgraded was that Biden publicly threatened Nord Stream 2. After the CIA came up with a plan of attack. If Russia invades, there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2, said Biden. We will bring an end to it. On February the 7th, 2022, he said that, just over a year before the Russian invasion. Hirsch's source says that after Biden's threat, the senior CIA officials said the plan was no longer a covert operation because the president has announced that we knew how to do it. According to the report, the operation was then downgraded from a covert op to a highly classified intelligence op. The source said that because of the change, there was no longer a legal requirement to report the operation to Congress. It said the US Navy divers planted C4 explosives on the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 in June. During the NATO drills in the region, the explosives were later detonated on the 26th of September by a sonar buoy, as you said, dropped by a Norwegian spy plane.
Yeah. Now, obviously, they didn't expect that this would come out in the way it has. And there's still more details. There's other people who've come forward and said that other whistleblowers have confirmed that this is probably how it was done. The Russians were pointing the finger at the British, the Royal Navy, for doing this.
Well,
that's what the Russians were saying, and I presume they knew what they were on about. But it looks clear that it was actually carried out by the US Navy, but with the connivance of the Norwegian, and of course, the acquiescence of the Swedes, the Finns, the Danes, and the Germans. I mean, the Germans have had their own pipeline blown up, which is going to wreck... The main damage is not to the Russian economy of this. The Russians will just build... You know, they've lost loads of stuff. They've lost 300 billion of their assets. The pipeline's been blown up. But they'll just build a pipeline to China and sell their gas over there.
Before we hear from Zelensky, who had all sorts of things to say after Prime Minister's questions, we're also hearing today the Ukraine is relying on the United States intelligence for its rocket strikes. Ukraine is prepared to strike Crimea with British missiles too.
Yes, and of course the Russians have said if you start shooting missiles that you are firing, because that's what it is, the Ukrainians are firing them with your support at Crimea, maybe the people on Salisbury Plain need to get into their air raid shelters. Yeah, that's how far they are. As you say, they're ready to fight World War III. In Europe.
Germany is now the main provider of tanks to Ukraine. We've also had all the commitment nearly to send British fighter jets there. So there is, in the background to all of this, there is this report, I think it was end of January, beginning of February, where the British Army is saying, well, actually, we're not really, we've got the equipment or the men to fight any kind of proper war now.
Well, they didn't in the first place. I mean,
Britain
cannot take on the Russian Federation in a war.
The equipment all seems to be going to Ukraine to such an extent that the British Army is no longer a proper fighting force, they say.
Well, I mean, from the Russian point of view, them putting dribs and drabs of stuff into the Ukraine for them to destroy is the way they'd like to deal with it. But there is no... But what makes me exasperated is all this stuff about sending them aircraft. Where are those aircraft going to fly from? Because any aircraft that enter Ukrainian airspace are going to be shot down immediately by the Russians.
A US general has warned this week, actually, that the British Army is no longer able to defend Britain and its allies.
Well, I mean, the British Army ought to be defending the British mainland, and that's all. That's the only job it should be doing.
Who's threatening the British mainland? Nobody.
Well, that's why. That's why we don't really need a big army. If we knew how to mind our own business, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in.
And also that the British Army would run out of ammunition in days if fought to fight Putin.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's not Putin anyway. Putin is just the president of the Russian Federation.
Well, that's just the Daily Express
headline. Well, I know, but that's the way in which they talk about it, because they want Putin to be like Hitler, and therefore it's just him and it's only him. These are fundamental conflicts of interest between different powerful systems, and the idea that it's all down to one man's crazy misbehaviour is childish and really dangerous. I mean, the lack of realism in the discussion.
Well, there
is
some realism in Republican circles in the States. They're saying that actually that we are putting together now a resolution to end support for the Ukraine war in the US Congress.
Okay, so you've got some in Germany, the opposition to what's going on comes from some on the left like Wagenknecht, but also from Alternative for Deutschland on the right. Now, of course, you can have comments that there's bound to be a spread of opinions about things like that in politics, left and right and all the rest of it. But it's also just, it's not right and left, it's right and wrong. You can't have...
It's called the Ukraine Fatigue Resolution, led by Republican Matt Gaetz, G-A-E-T-Z, not Gaetz as in Bill Gaetz, and received 10 other co-sponsors. If it passes, it will express that it's a sense of the House that the United States must end its military and financial aid to Ukraine and urges all combatants to reach a peace agreement. Now, you know, quite a lot of this might well be that the US senators and congressmen and women must be thinking to themselves, look, if they're going to go behind our back and blow up Nord Stream 2, we're going to get a little bit annoyed about that. The White House is not totally in charge. What about us? You've got to run this stuff past us.
Yeah. Well, I think in the United States itself, you can imagine, despite all the propaganda, there's quite a lot of people thinking, hang on a minute, we've got plenty of things to spend our money on at home. Why are we spending, our money on the Ukraine,
the
which most people can't find on the map?
Part of this resolution says America is in a state of managed decline, and it will exacerbate if we continue to hemorrhage taxpayer dollars towards a foreign war.
Okay, so, I mean, I welcome the outgrowth of common sense. I mean, you've got people like Peter Hitchens in this country who's on the right of politics, really, and he's got common sense. The thing about war is it isn't just about right and wrong. It's also about what's actually feasible and not feasible. And, of course, people's delusions about it are that it's actually morally straightforward and it's just weakness that we don't do this and that and the other. And it's actually completely the opposite. NATO had a death squad that shot dead the protesters, pro-EU protesters in 2014. We know this in Kiev. We know this from a court case in Kiev. And I feel like saying to Keir Starmer, the former director of public prosecutions, are you aware of that court case and the result of that court case? And do you know what the answer is, Tony? No. Because MI6 haven't told him about it. Because MI6 were behind it.
I'm only told what I'm told by the spooks. Anyway,
right.
Just before we hear from Zelensky, we're going to hear one of the other questions. There were loads of questions at Prime Minister's Questions, all about Ukraine, nothing to do with food banks here, I'm afraid. But because Zelensky was over here speaking to both houses of Parliament in Westminster Hall just after PMQs, but this question popped up too.
Mr. Speaker, across this House, we don't just hope for Ukraine's victory, we believe in it. And part of that victory must be Ukraine's reconstruction. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that Russia should pay for the destruction it has caused through the wealth lying dormant in blocked Russian government assets?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we are the third largest humanitarian and economic donor to Ukraine, £1.4 billion of support that we have provided through direct grant assistance and guarantees at multilateral lending organisations. And again, the House will remember we took a lead in imposing economic sanctions on Russian entities, including individuals and state-sanctioned assets. We've ensured the provision of funds here will be put in a foundation for reconstruction in Ukraine, and we are currently working with international partners through the legal process to use those assets to fund Ukrainian reconstruction. Of course, that's something that we all want to see, and we're working with our partners to achieve that.
Well, this Naomi Klein and disaster capitalism comes to mind here, but also, of course, much of the reconstruction is being done by the Russians anyway, because actually, as the line is moving forward, westwards and northwards in Ukraine, it's the Russians that are picking up the pieces and putting the houses back together again.
That's true, and of course, Russia's international assets have been seized. I mean, the Russians and the Germans might be in a position to sue the Americans and the Norwegians for the losses of blowing up their pipeline. Think of the consequences of the German economy. The German economy is going to crash. Probably lots of people will die because they will die early because of austerity that the German government will have to introduce, all of which should be compensated by those that have blown the pipeline.
He's also,
surely.
Did you also talk about loans there? So, of course, there's more getting people
Ukraine has been raped by the IMF since the 1990s. Virtually all of it was actually one of the more developed of the Soviet republics. You know, the quality of life in Ukraine was far higher than it was in some of the stands, for example. And they had a sophisticated economy. But it's all the 1990s in Ukraine were, if anything, worse than what happened in Russia. The oligarchy were given total free rein because of the more pro-Western orientation of Ukraine's politics. The oligarchy were given absolutely, you know, they got everything they wanted without any pushback at all. In Russia itself, there was eventually pushback from the state and from the wider society on the oligarchy, not in the Ukraine.
Anyway, after Prime Minister's questions, after a little comfort break, the MPs were treated to their Big Brother superstar. And here are a couple of extracts from Zelensky's talk to the combined houses of the British Parliament in Westminster Hall.
And of course, everybody understands that our countries knew absolutely different times. Our nations defended freedom in the Second World War. The Iron Curtain divided us. Our people went through crisis and growth, through inflation and periods of social losses and social gains. It was tough, but we always found strength and stamina to move ahead and achieve results. This is the bedrock of our land and your traditions. Ukrainians and Brits defeated the fear of war and had the time to enjoy peace. No matter what we encountered on different stages of our and your formidable history, and you and us and the whole mankind achieved similar result. Evil lost. Evil lost. We will always come out on top of evil. This lies at the core of our, but also your, traditions. However, the horizon never stays clear for a while. Once the old evil is defeated, the new one is attempting to raise its head. Do you have a feeling that the evil will crumble once again? I can see in your eyes now, we think the same way as you do. We know freedom will win.
Well, I think it's quite extraordinary when he says we fought on the same side in World War II, because the Banderites, who are in control of policy in the Ukraine, fought for the Nazis. So in actual fact, that's just historically wrong. Insofar as the Ukrainians fought the Nazis, they were fighting as part of the Soviet forces, that is to say, led by Russian commanders like Zhukov. And of course, the war in the Ukraine in the Second World War between the Nazis and the Russians, and the Soviets as they then were, was by far the most consequential battle of all. What happened in Britain was essentially a sideshow. And of course, this is just a complete distortion of history. And of course, you've got these fools in the party. You know, in Russia itself, They actually follow what we do far more than we follow what they do. They watch our news programs. We don't watch their news programs. We don't speak Russian and we don't care to find out what they think. But they absolutely disgust people in Russia when Zelensky comes out with that sort of stuff.
Martin, I mean, RT did a fantastic job for a decade or so
that's why they banned it.
With, English language broadcasting from around the world. The Iranians do the same as well.
Yes, but they were banned as well. So, in other words, this is an incredible, they've brought him in, and the speech has been written by British intelligence.
You reckon?
I think so. That's what happened when he went to the US. So he's pushing all these buttons about Britain, our values. We defeated evil, and he's patting everyone. Oh yes, we defeated evil.
What he's saying, what he's really saying is that the West and NATO won the Cold War, isn't he?
Yeah, well,
the Soviet Union collapsed as a result.
Yes, I know, but he's talking about defeating freedom. What he's referring to is the defeat of Nazi Germany, which is, of course, very ironic, because the Nazi...
No, I think he's talking about the Cold War at that point.
Well, I misinterpreted then. And in any case, the Cold War ended because the Soviet elite decided they'd had enough and threw in the towel. And they then said... Putin at one stage was saying, when can we join NATO? And, of course, they said, well, you're not joining NATO. Yeah, the Ukraine used to have a very oligarchic setup, and it was the economic policy was rubbish. But at least they were in. They knew that they got to balance. Ukraine is in a position where it's got to be either a bridge or a battlefield, and they've decisively chosen the ones in charge, not the people in the East Ukraine, who obviously didn't want to be a battlefield. They've chosen to be a battlefield. And of course, Zelensky will eventually, when the Ukrainian state mate collapses, and it may happen quite quickly, he will just go off to Florida with his billions that he's made
Two weeks ago, we had all these announcements about battle tanks going to Ukraine, of course, leaving the British without their own battle tanks to defend Britain if they wanted to. And now this week, it's been fighter jets. This is quite important, isn't it? The idea of air superiority, as we know in any modern war.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, the reason is that the military industry people behind all of this, what happens when we send our Challenger tanks is that then they say, well, we'll have to have some new Challenger tanks, so that's more money to spend on Challenger tanks instead of on hospital beds, for example. Mm. Yeah. And of course, the real costs of all of this is that the world economy has been put into turmoil by it all. And it's not the Russian invasion, it's the sanctions. And that means we've got no money for anything else. People ask why we haven't got money for things. It's because we've got these delusions of grandeur, the absurdity of tin pot politicians in Britain who have no idea about foreign affairs.
It sounds
frankly,
to me,
talking about the way they're talking,
it's basically
it is delusionary.
A plot and a conspiracy by the Americans to drag Europe into war again.
That's right, and of course, what they're also doing is they're wrecking the German economy so that won't be any kind of threat to them. The real victims of this is not going to be Russia; it's going to be Germany, and of course, impoverishing Germany as a result of geopolitics could easily come unstuck, as it has twice before.
We know Russia will lose. And we really know the victory will change the world. And this will be a change that the world has long needed. The United Kingdom is marching with us towards the most important victory of our lifetime. It will be a victory over the very idea of the war. After we win together, any aggressor, it doesn't matter, big or small, will know what awaits him if he attacks international order. Any aggressor who will try to push the boundaries by force, who will inflict destruction and death on other peoples, who will try to endure his dictatorship at the expense of other people's blood in criminal and unprovoked wars, as the Kremlin does, any aggressor is going to lose. Ladies and gentlemen, We have already achieved remarkable results, and we must make every effort to turn our achievements into the foundations of the future global security architecture. The world needs your leadership, Britain, just as it needs Ukrainian bravery.
I get the impression that Zelensky's actually looking for the applause, pausing and waiting, and then the applause is kind of catching up with him.
Well, that's because it's a whole thing is a scripted PR exercise, isn't it?
You know, so it's like canned applause or something.
Well, it's not canned applause.
Well, I know it isn't, but it's like, you know, he's saying, wait, now you're supposed to be applauding now. Come on, hurry up.
Yes, I know. In other words, this isn't a dialogue, is it? It's a rant. And of course, when he says, we will win and we're definitely having a victory, he's been told to say, you've got to sound like Churchill. Now, Churchill actually wasn't that smart, to be honest with you. He used to talk like that as well about going to war in South Africa and places like that. And he was wrong then. And Zelensky's wrong now. I mean, I can't imagine why people are listening to that saying, what does a victory for the Ukrainians mean? They're going to retake every centimetre of the Ukrainian state
including
created
Crimea.
In 1991.
Including Crimea.
The state of Ukraine has only existed since 1991. And it was only created because of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It never existed in history before that. It was actually what is now Ukraine. Some of it was part of Russia. Some of it was part of Austria-Hungarian Empire. And some of it was part of Poland. Yeah? So in actual fact, it's never existed as a state until recently.
Well, the Russians did see Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference last year saying that he wanted nuclear weapons as quite a provocation, plus the 15,000 people in the Donbass. One does wonder if, the West the Ukrainian oligarchs should pay for the reconstruction of all those places that they blew up between 2014 and last year.
I think what's going to happen is that the Russians are not going to get their money back. It's been stolen. It's gone for good. But they're going to get their revenge, but they're not going to do
that. You know what?
They're not going to pay any debts either.
The Russians are quite contented with the way that things have gone because they're getting a lot more money from India and places like that now as the gas goes that way rather than west, and they're quids in, actually. Despite all these sanctions from what's going on.
That's right.
They can afford to ramp up their arms production if necessary.
Well, and also it's a nationalised arms industry, and they've been preparing for this since 2014, because they knew exactly what happened in the Maidan Square in 2014. A NATO death squad from Georgia killed the pro-EU demonstrators and the Burkut riot police. We know that from the court case.
And once
they realised that was what was going on, they started to prepare for war. Whereas in Britain, of course, what's happened is, with what's happened last year, the British have suddenly decided they want to go to war with Russia. The Russians have been preparing for this war for years. Well, are we ready? The answer is no. We're not even ready to manage our own affairs, run the trains on time in Britain, never mind a war with the Russians.
I was, in a way, quite heartened, because this was a sort of Big Brothers-type speech that was given in Westminster Hall. The idea, everyone is supposed to be behind it. And yet, actually, there seemed to be a bit of a kind of reluctance to clap him. But here is the final crescendo of Zelensky's speech to the combined houses of the British Parliament this week.
Great Britain, you and us both struggle for peace, but instead of we are forced to face the range that seeks to deprive us of peace and everything else that is valuable in life. Unfortunately, it is in human nature to allow evil mature. It then stands up against humanity. It then destroys and kills. It launches aggressions and breaks people's lives. You and us have already fought together against such evil. You and us already have the experience of defeating the evil that is generated by human nature. I'm not saying there will be no more wars after the war ends. No, it is impossible to completely erase evil from human nature. Yet it is in our power to guarantee with words and deeds that the light side of human nature will prevail. The side you and us share. And this stands above anything else. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your support and leaving a British Parliament 2 years ago. I thanked you for delicious English tea. And I will be leaving the Parliament today, thanking all of you in advance for powerful English planes. By the way, it's almost 5 o'clock. God bless Great Britain and long, long live the King. Slava Ukraini!
Well, that slogan at the end, Slava Ukraini, means glory to Ukraine. And it was, in fact, the slogan of the Banderites who fought with the Germans against the Russians in World War II. And when he says we fought together, he's not talking about the Cold War, he's talking about the Second World War. So, cheekily, Zelensky is pretending that the Ukrainians, who did fight bravely in the Soviet side, he's claiming them as the ancestors of what he's doing, which is blatantly not the case.
Why not? Why not?
Because on January the 1st this year, it's Bandera's birthday, okay? And in the Ukrainian Rada, they all had a big celebration of Bandera's birthday. And Zalushny, who's the commander of the Ukrainian forces, he was videoed in front of a picture of Stepan Bandera. Now, people can look up Stepan Bandera. Stepan Bandera fought for the Germans against the Soviets, against us, against the British, because the British were allied with the Soviets at that stage. And there's Zelensky in the British Parliament claiming Ukraine was the ones that defeated Hitlerism, and implying that Putin is also Hitler, which, of course, is absurd. You know, I mean, everybody's Hitler. Saddam Hussein's Hitler. I mean, it makes Saddam Hussein sound too big and Hitler look too small.
Well, he's saying basically because of it's his invasion. Putin is evil. We are all united against evil, and he seems to be suggesting that by beating Russia and Ukraine, evil can then be banished from the earth.
Well, can't people see what's wrong with that kind of rhetoric? This battle in the Ukraine would be recognised by Bismarck and Palmerston and Talleyrand and other diplomats of the 19th century as a classic turf struggle. And you know what? The concert of Europe tried to prevent these kind of turf struggles, and they set up a mechanism for everybody to try and, you know, to rub along. It didn't quite work. It ended up in World War I because there was too many people pushing too many agendas. But this kind of talk about defeating evil is very dangerous, because what it means is we're not talking about anything that we can rationally argue about. If something's evil, you've just got to oppose it, and that's all there is to
it.
There's no discussion of tactics or anything like that, or even the possibility, dare I say it, of a negotiated solution.
Well,
like most wars in history have ended in a negotiated solution.
Why not, Roger Walters? God save the king and Slava Ukraini. Yes. So anyway, now on to something slightly more sensible on Ukraine. Our final little piece is with the one and only Scott Ritter, who did a piece. I mean, he does his own program, which is excellent. And I mean, what I should really do is put a link to that up on our show page as well at thisweek.org.uk. Although it's a little bit, I mean, he's talking to the Russians about what they think is going on. So I'll put that full interview up too. We're not going to hear from that now, though. We're going to hear from Scott talking about what exactly is going on, in his own words, being interviewed by somebody else.
Russia was pushing for a negotiated settlement almost immediately after this war began. The war began on February 24th. By March 3rd, the Russians were already engaged in, I think even earlier than that, were engaged in negotiations to bring this conflict to an end. They had three negotiations between early March and March 6th that set down the conditions. On April 1st, they were scheduled to meet in Istanbul for a final peace agreement, that an agreement would be signed. And part of that, to set that agreement up, Russia carried out what was called a confidence building measure. They withdrew from huge amounts of Ukrainian territory saying, see, we're not here to take your territory. We're withdrawing. Now let's sign the peace treaty. And what happened? The United States and NATO bullied the Ukrainians into backing out. In fact, the Ukrainian head of the Ukrainian intelligence service has pretty much said, we weren't negotiating in good faith. This was just designed to buy time. For what? Well, what happened in May? NATO, the United States, voted a new Lend-Lease Act, $40 billion worth of American taxpayer money used for military assistance, where we enabled the Ukrainians to build up a new military, and then they attacked the Russians. And they had some success. They drove the Russians out of Kharkov. They captured the right bank of Kherson. But in doing so, they changed the nature of the conflict. This stopped being Russia versus Ukraine. And this became Russia versus NATO. And now, FAFO. Fool around, find out. You know, there's an old Russian saying, and I butcher it sometimes. I've had my Russian friends correct me. But the Russians are slow to harness, but fast to ride. And what that means is, just imagine you got some big old stallion in the field, and you want to get moving, but he don't want to play. He wants to eat grass, chase mares, do whatever stallions do. Okay, but it takes you a little bit of time to put the harness on him. He's fighting, yeah, he's struggling, doesn't want to do it. But now you got the harness on, he's ready to rock. He's going to take you down that road. The Russians didn't want to put on the harness of war. They didn't want this. They had a limited objective, a special military operation, but NATO and Ukraine turned it into the NATO conflict that Russia was trying to avoid from the very beginning, since the Minsk Accords. Now Russia's harnessed, and they're going for a ride. And that ride is this offensive. 300,000 men were mobilized. Another 180,000 so volunteers were brought in and trained. Some of the most modern equipment coming out of Russian factories has been used to equip these forces. Meanwhile, this NATO-Ukrainian army has been ground down into nothing. I mean, some of the death figures coming out are just mind-boggling. Let's just remind your audience, in the 10 years of Vietnam, we lost some 58,000 Americans. And it broke our heart, broke our spirit. 58,000 in 10 years. During the height of the Vietnam conflict, we were suffering, say, 200, 220 dead a week. And it crushed us as a nation. Ukrainians, in less than a year, have suffered anywhere ranging from 157,000 dead to over 300,000 dead. In the entire World War II, America lost 300,000 dead. The entire World War II, that's against Nazi Germany, Imperial Japan, and everything else in between, 300,000 dead. The Ukrainians probably have lost that or more in less than a year in fighting against the Russians. If this doesn't break your heart, nothing will. Now, the Russians are engaged in this conflict too. Normally, your casualty ratios in militaries, let's take a look at, let's say, Germany versus the United States in World War II or Germany versus the Soviet Union. Your casualty ratios tended to be about 1 to 1.2, 1 to 1.3, meaning that the winning side is suffering 1, the losing side suffering 1.2, 1.3. So in a war of attrition, you grind them down, and the side that's suffering less casualties tends to win. The Russians right now are enjoying more than a 10 to 1 advantage in terms of death ratio. So, you know, we're talking, maybe the Russians have suffered 20, 30,000 dead. Guys, that's a lot. Let's just break that down for a second. 20 to 30,000 dead in a year. That's 3,000 a month, or maybe a little less than 3,000 a month. And then we roll into what that constitutes in a week. The Russians are suffering three times as many dead per week than we suffered during the height of the Vietnam War. And the casualties we suffered broke us as a nation. Russia today is suffering three times as many casualties as that, and the Ukrainians are suffering 10 times as many casualties as that. So everybody who's sitting here talking about, oh, that Russian-Ukrainian war is sort of an abstract, guys are dying. And it's the most vicious kind of death. There's nothing, this ain't Hollywood. This ain't, oh, I got shot. I'm going to die and give a little speech before I die, and everybody will cry. This is bodies being blown apart, guts pouring out, bodies burning, heads being decapitated, arms torn off, bleeding out. The worst things that you could imagine is happening every single day. Hundreds of people are dying. Civilians are starving. Infrastructure is being destroyed. And yet, this war ain't over. It's going to end soon. When I say soon, it's going to end sometime this year. But for it to end, those 300,000 Russian troops that have been mobilized, are going to have to be committed to this battle. And that's happening now. Some people believe, including myself, that the offensive has already begun. You know, the Russians, they've never been good about explaining their war to us because it's not their job. That's why people like me and you and others are out there trying to guess what's going on. You know, hey, what's going on? I don't know. The Kremlin didn't call me this morning and give me the update. So I have to look at all the news and sort of, you know, make guesswork. But my guesswork right now is that the offensive has already begun. It's going to continue to increase and escalate. And the level of violence is going to be, is going to blow out of proportion. But that's where they're at. And here's the news flash for America. We picked the wrong side again. We started this. We supported the Ukrainians, and they're going to lose. And there's nothing we can do to change that outcome. The fact is, if we claim to care about the Ukrainian people, let me give you just a simple statement of fact. Every tank we provide the Ukrainians is a guaranteed 4 more Ukrainian dead. Every armored fighting vehicle we provide will have a squad of 7 to 11 people inside that would be blown up by the Russians, so those are more dead. We are killing Ukrainians. We are guaranteeing tens of thousands of Ukrainian deaths in an effort that cannot change the outcome. Russia is winning, and Russia will win this war. And all we're doing by helping the Ukrainians is prolonging the suffering and sacrifice of that nation. There's mothers, there's sisters, there's wives, there's sons, there's uncles, there's grandparents who are losing people they love every single day in a war that didn't need to be fought and shouldn't be fought and should be brought to an end, but it won't be because the United States is yet again engaged in a policy. And you hear all, people are like, well, that's not what I'm hearing from the American government. Oh, really? I wonder why. Let's go back to Afghanistan. If you remember in June and July of 2021, we were being told that we are committed. This fight is important. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda must be destroyed. We cannot retreat. This is of strategic importance, blah, 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 blah. August, we're out. Why? Because we got beat. And this is what's happening in Ukraine now. We're talking, we're doing this. I'm telling you right now, come August, September, October, we're out. Why? Because we got beat. America stands for nothing. We are the worst friends in the world. If you're a friend of America, it's guaranteed you're going to suffer. Your men are going to die.
Well, it's a very heartfelt analysis, isn't it, from Scott Ritter, who, as you know, listeners will know, was a UN weapons inspector in Iraq, but he began his career working with the Russian military on strategic nuclear deals. Yeah, so he's got a very good, sound knowledge of how the Russians think, because he's known their military people for years.
It's actually very important. He gets into the kill ratios there. These are really critical. He's talking about World War II being roughly 1 to 1.2, so that's, you know, we're talking in rough figures about 4 Allied soldiers were dying for every 5 Germans, and these kinds of figures are absolutely crucial. And he says what's going on right now in the special military operation in Ukraine, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Ukrainians are suffering 10 casualties for every 1 Russian.
Yes, they are. And in actual fact, if you think to the Second World War, the Germans actually had a better kill ratio, but they just didn't have enough forces. Yeah, they were ground down in the end. And of course, this is then projected onto modern Russian military doctrine. Oh, they're just throwing untrained conscripts into the meat grinder. Putin will fall once the mums get on the streets of it and oppose the war. It's the Ukrainians who are throwing away, and they're doing it for political reasons. In order to keep the Western seals clapping in British Parliament, they carry out offensives which have got no military purpose so that they can show that they're still fighting. And there's massive profiteering going on. The Ukraine was always incredibly corrupt. So these Challenger tanks, if they get to the Ukraine, they could easily be just cannibalised and sold onto the international market.
Well, the other thing is, what I'll do is I'll put an extra interview up this week. I'm not going to actually have an excerpt from it, but it's the Scott Ritter Show, where he interviews this guy, Andriy Klintchevich, who's a Russian statesman, he says, a military expert in the field of weapons and military equipment, graduate of one of the military academies and the military university in the Ministry of Defense in the Russian Federation, and former Special Forces officer and the Regiment of the Russian Airborne Forces. very interesting. I mean, he's talking, saying, for example, all these tanks which are being sent to Ukraine, what's happening right now is that the Americans are agreeing to replace them. So rather than buying British or European tanks, the European countries and the British are agreeing to buy new American tanks.
Yeah, so in other words...
The Abrams.
Yeah, so the US military industry, if you look at the share prices of things like Raytheon and so on, going through the roof because of all of this. The other thing the Americans are doing is they've brought in this Inflation Reduction Act, which means massive subsidies to their green industries, which completely defies World Trade Organization
rules. Under his state of emergency, isn't it right that Zelensky is now starting to privatise everything over there?
That's right, and of course he's actually banned all pro-Russian political parties. Medvedchuk, who was the leader of the opposition in the Rada, was beaten up and generally ill-treated, but he was then traded as a prisoner for Ukrainian soldiers. So the leader of the opposition in the Ukraine has been treated as a military prisoner.
And maybe that's why Starmer's behaving himself here, eh?
Well, the thing about Starmer is he's a genuine believer.
They don't want
in
any opposition, do they? They don't want any opposition. And if there is opposition, they're taking it out.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the campaign group of Labour MPs are more sceptical about what's going on. But even they can't get to the real evil, if we're going to keep using the word evil, of NATO intelligence services, who at the very beginning of the crisis in 2014 brought in 50 snipers from Georgia, which then shot dead both police officers and protesters so they could carry out a military coup which put in a pro-Western Nazi government, Banderite government in Ukraine. Now, people in Russia, they have modern media. Modern Russia is very similar to the West. They have lots of TV stations, lots of different points of view, and they're all united in disgust at what the West has done in the Ukraine. And of course, we've got no vision of that whatsoever because we're not allowed to know what the Russians
think.
Well,
we did get a bit of it before they shut RT down. So ultimately, Martin, they're talking about we are going to win. We're obviously not going to win. So where is this going to end? Scott is saying he thinks it's going to end this year with a massive Russian offensive.
Well, I think it's
will complete the operation, yeah, number one, to take out Zelensky and the Ukrainian government, and number two, this was one of their main aims, was to denazify. I mean, they see it as a Nazi government, effectively, and the other thing is to liberate the Donbass and these places. So once that's done, maybe
the
whole thing will be
over. The Donbass and these other places?
Yeah, to liberate them from the Ukrainian...
you went at the Russian point of view.
Yeah.
Well, one of the other interesting thing that happened this week, did you see Naftali Bennett, the former Prime Minister of Israel? He came out and he was working with Erdogan to settle this dispute in March last year, and he said, we had a deal on the table. The Israelis were playing mediator, yeah, with the Turks. And we said we had a deal on the table. Zelensky was happy with it. The Russians were happy with it. And you know who sabotaged that deal?
You said earlier.
The British.
Yeah, Boris.
Well, no, he didn't do it on his own, did he?
No.
He did it because it's
MI6,
settled British
MI6
policy
and NATO.
To create trouble with Russia.
Anyway, we've got another item before we finish, two, actually. One is, I think, quite important. It's an interview that I've done, and I'm going to put it up online tonight, with Robert Green, who's the nephew of Hilda Morell, and he lives over in Christchurch in New Zealand. We found out all sorts of things about the death of this anti-nuclear campaigner back in the 1980s, and he's done a book called A Thorn in Their Side, which came out in 2011, and another edition of it in 2013. The play on the word thorn was because Hilda was actually a rose grower. But anyway, we found out all sorts of interesting things about her. In this little two-part thing you're going to hear now, there's a much longer version going to go up online. But first of all, we look at the Hilda herself, who she actually was. And particularly Andrew George, who was incarcerated for at least 15 years for her murder, Hilda's murder, in 2005, which they considered to be a total miscarriage of justice.
We felt that the story had to get out there. There is definitely a miscarriage of justice. Both of us have met him in prison. We're absolutely convinced that he did not do it on his own. He was in the house, but he could not have done what they say he did. And even if he did take 40 pounds, he has done his time for aggravated burglary many, many years ago. He should not still be in prison 17 years on. So I think that The book caused a stir in New Zealand to a point where our politicians were very concerned that both of us, as leaders in the international disarmament and peace movement, were being harassed with break-ins to our house, our mail being intercepted, all my UN Secretary General papers were being intercepted. It's absolutely unbelievable that this was happening in New Zealand right from the first letters we wrote to each other. Why is that happening if Andrew George is the right man? Mm-hmm. Why is it still happening to us? Why are the boxes of books of the new edition coming from Britain here? Every single box is cut open and tyres are slashed at different times in Britain or here. They must not like us exposing what we know about Hilda. And Hilda, before she was abducted on that day, she was ringing people in the peace movement in her local peace group to say, I've got sensitive papers, I need them published, where would I get them published? I'm coming to the meeting tonight, can you bring a stout bag? And she never got to the meeting, she was abducted that day. Now, what was it that she knew that is still so sensitive to the British government? She knew a lot about nuclear power, she knew a lot about nuclear weapons, but because she was a spy, potentially from Bletchley Park, and people have come forward and told us this, what did she know that has still not come out that is sensitive enough that we still get harassment both here and in Britain?
Sorry, can you just clarify what you said there about Bletchley Park?
Rob can answer this
one. Yes, it was very interesting that when we launched the first edition that you've got of the book in Shrewsbury in 2012, we had a huge public meeting. And if you go to the website, hildamarl.org, you will see a link to the film, because we had that meeting filmed. And it was standing room only. And after the meeting, a woman in the front row, an old woman, came forward to me who was nervous and took me outside in the dark and said, basically, I want you to know that Hilda was a supervisor of a team of young women working on code breaking at Bletchley Park, the famous Enigma code in World War II. She was a top spy in World War II. And so this thickened the plot considerably for us, because it meant that she was an insider. She was one of them. And so
this wasn't known about in your family at all, Rob, no?
No. Mind you, if you ask any members of the family of those whose grannies were at Bletchley Park, they'll all say the same. It was such a tight secret, although it was declassified in 2008, and that's when the fun started, when lots of old ladies came forward saying, I can now tell you, that I was headhunted as a smart young woman who could do crosswords in 20 minutes and was a linguist. And Hilda was certainly one of them, but she was more than that. She was in her 30s by then. And she also was director of Family Rose Nursery. She had tremendous cover job. She was single, unattached, Cambridge graduate, extremely smart. And she had very good contacts.
And following up on the contacts, I've done a lot of research since people have come forward to us about Bletchley. That's not the only example. But in this book, the latest version, we have a whole chapter with information of people about coming forward. But at Bletchley, when I looked at the names of her friends and Googled a lot of them and read their obituaries, many of them were in SOE. They said they worked at Bletchley, or it was in their obituaries. And, of course, she used to go and stay with them in these aristocratic homes all around the country and even in France. And, of course, she would have had contacts. And she would know how to hide information, to be careful. She was incredibly well-researched in what she wrote. And she would have been respected by a lot of those people who had been at Bletchley and who, if they had information that they knew was sensitive, they would trust someone like Hilda to go public on it. And she was definitely trying to do that. And she was also recording in her diaries, or with friends, the harassment she was receiving, not just with writing the paper she was about to give, but also, she was getting break-ins to her house, mail open, same sort of stuff that we get.
So that's from Christchurch, New Zealand, Kate Dews there and her husband Rob Green, who's in the British Naval Intelligence for the Royal Navy back in the early 1980s when his aunt, Hilda Morell, was murdered, Martin. She was presenting evidence particularly to do with the nuclear waste that would be coming out of the Sizewell B nuclear power station.
Well, this is a big can of worms, isn't it? And, of course, what they believe is that the person who's been found guilty of this murder, in fact, is not guilty, and that there's more to it than meets the eye.
Yeah, I mean, that's how we started. That's how we started there with this guy called Andrew George is doing time. He was aged 37 in 2005 and was given a life sentence and ordered to serve at least 15 years before he could be considered for parole. Well, he is, the BBC reported, in 2012 that the killer's cellmate says there were others involved. And as you'll hear in the longer interview with Kate and Rob, this guy couldn't even drive. Now, a car was definitely involved in her murder. So, you know, and it is interesting, isn't it, that Hilda was World War II deep state in a way. She's a supervisor at Bletchley Park, and so she was very well connected and adamant against nuclear power campaigner.
Yeah, and it's very, I mean, and I think people who've been in the secret world, the people who run the secret world, regard people who've been in it, who then turn against the secret world, as it were, as fair game. And, you know, people say...
Yeah, but this isn't necessarily the case, is it? I mean,
no,
because
of course it's not the case, it's wrong.
I mean, as I say to them in the interview, what you've got is you've got the British, actually, and the Germans, funnily enough, before the war, British at Nuffield University in the Second World War, Frisch and Piles, as Hungarian and German scientists, developing the idea for the nuclear bomb. Then something was done called the Quebec Agreement with Churchill and Roosevelt, that the idea was that this was all going to be developed in the United States. So there was an understanding that the Americans had broken that agreement, you know, and there were certain people in the deep state here in Britain during World War II that were rather annoyed about that. And anyway, they thought the Americans weren't handling the whole nuclear business very sensibly, especially after unnecessarily wiping so many people out at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So there was a part of the deep state in Britain was actually quite annoyed with the way the Americans had dealt with the whole situation.
Well, you may be putting your finger on tensions between, you know, British actors and US actors. Obviously, we don't know the full details of what she knew and why she was murdered. But the idea that she was murdered by the state is quite straightforward. I don't think anybody in West Belfast would be surprised to learn that the British get up to this kind of thing.
The nuclear industry, and it might be the Americans too involved.
Well, it could be. We don't know. What we do know is that the story they've told us is a load of rubbish. And that's true of an awful lot of things that go down, isn't it?
Anyway, so the full interview with Rob Green and Kate Dews will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as well as a video, too, popping up on YouTube and BitChute later. But finally, I asked Rob about nuclear power today.
The propaganda battle rages on about nuclear power's role in the... solving the climate crisis, but it's a nonsense because it's too expensive. It takes far too long. By the time Hinkley C was ever up and running, we'd all be fried. But all the alternative is, of course, that the renewables will have solved the problem. And so it is an absolute irrelevance, and it's a terrible conceit, basically. But the nuclear industry has never been short of public relations. They have always had this dream that they were going to prevail one day and they would be needed, bless them. And so this is their latest attempt. And Hinkley Point C, they've been trying ever since Sizewell was built to get a second PWR up and running. And Hinkley is the latest effort. And I found myself caught up in opposing Hinkley C back in 1989 to 1990, And I learned a lot more about the nuclear industry then.
Rob, you, one of your papers was, I think you delivered to one of the inquiries, was called Can Democracy Survive with Nuclear Power? It's like what you're saying is that the two are incompatible. And I wonder, could you just explain that? Because certainly we've been living with nuclear power and apparently democracy for the last 80 years or so.
Yes. Well, of course, the first thing is that no way could you really call the United Kingdom a democracy. It is an oligarchy. It is I better not go on about that, but basically, we need to actually get things straight here. It's an elective dictatorship. And so this is the sort of world that nuclear power can thrive in, because of course, the only way nuclear power is going to get its way is through secrecy. And so, and basically the link with nuclear weapons helps the nuclear industry basically cover up its tracks, and any faults that it may have discovered or maybe in the designs are always suppressed. And this is basically what I set out to do at the Hinkley Inquiry, was to expose some of those.
Hilda Murrell's nephew, Rob Green, there speaking to me from Christchurch, New Zealand this week. He's pretty damning about the whole nuclear industry, Martin, and yet there are quite a lot of so-called Greens who are waving the flag saying this is the future.
Well, I agree that this, the nuclear industry, as far as I can see, doesn't make economic sense. But of course, in places like Russia and China, they've developed nuclear industry, and in France. And once you've got a nuclear industry, it doesn't make sense just to switch it off overnight, as happened in Germany. We're going to be dealing with the waste for, thousands of years to come. And, there'll be plenty of jobs for nuclear engineers dealing with that. Although I did read this week that Rosatom, which is the Russian nuclear industry, claim to have closed the fuel cycle, which means that spent nuclear fuel is just recycled in as more fuel, and therefore you don't generate any further nuclear waste. I'm sceptical of that, but in any case, from an economic point of view, we've got a lot of nuclear power now. We can't just switch it off, but we certainly don't have to build any more and waste, and cut our losses in relation to, because it doesn't make economic sense. And once you factor in all of the things like what we're going to do with the waste.
Oh, well, the thing is that the actual nuclear reactions create all these things called actinides, which are radioactive isotopes of ordinary elements. So there's all sorts of nasty stuff like iodine, for example. Radioactive iodine comes out. So all you'll be doing is concentrating that radioactive iodine and all these other actinides and putting it back into the reactor again, and they slow the reactor down. So I mean, the idea that they've come out with some sort of magic bullet, I think.
I'm sceptical, but I've read somebody. I read widely on the internet, and that's one of the things I read. But Britain hasn't got a big nuclear industry. France has. Other countries have. But, you don't have to join in just because other people are doing it. It just depends, doesn't it? What we really need to do, if we're going to solve not just the climate crisis, but generally the degradation of the environment, is basically quite straightforward. It's called energy conservation. Everything should be massively energy efficient.
Maybe we should put Goldie from Stonehenge in charge.
Well, maybe. I mean, obviously, he's got some political aspirations, if you like.
Also, just a quickie on Ukraine. Newsweek this week reports that US colonel training Zelensky as forces accuses soldiers of war atrocities. Andrew Milburn, a retired US Marine colonel who spent months in Ukraine helping to train Zelensky's forces, said during, and luckily he didn't get killed, bombed or whatever by the Russians, even though he was in Ukraine training their forces, said during a recent interview there had been all kinds of atrocities. Milburn's the founder and chief executive of the Mozart Group, a company composed mainly of former special operations soldiers that provide services to Ukraine, ranging from frontline. This is privatisation of the military, isn't it? Max Blumenthal, founder of the Grey Zone, posted a clip on Twitter this week of Milburn speaking last month at the Team House podcast. Ukraine, he says, is a corrupt, effed up society run by effed up people. Ukrainian soldiers kill dudes who surrendered and commit atrocities.
Well, I mean, the Bucha massacre, which happened at this time last year, and of course you had, it happened not long after this time last year, and it was all claimed as this is the Russians are terrible, they've massacred all. Do you know what will come out in the end? That was carried out by the Ukrainian SBU.
Well,
and the
I think
Azov
in
Battalion.
In some places it has come out, hasn't it? A lot of evidence has come out.
Well, I mean,
carried
in actual fact,
Ukrainians.
This is no surprise to Russian-speaking Ukrainians.
Because
they've been on the
fighting.
Receiving end of the violence of this regime since 2014.
Fighting
and of course,
a media war.
Yes, indeed.
They seem to be, you know, because they now, they know that the Russians can't get their ore in the Western world in the media anymore, that they can do atrocities and then blame it on the Russians.
Well, that's
and they can get away with that in the press.
That's true, but I also think that the strategy of carrying out atrocities and then blaming on the Russians is clearly a NATO intelligence strategy. The original shootings in the Maidan Square weren't carried out by a local death squad. They were carried out by people who had been brought in from mostly from Georgia and two from Lithuania. In other words, it was orchestrated by NATO intelligence services, not by the local fascists.
Okay.
Although the MH17 shoot down, that was carried out by a plane from Kiev, according to BBC Russia, who reported from people who'd seen the plane shoot the thing down.
Anyway,
we live in the empire of lies, Tony.
Well, we do, but we're going to be telling some truth, we hope, next week with a special feature on the Bilderbergs coming up in May. We've got lots of notice of where they are in Lisbon, so we'll be doing something on that next week. We're also sorry, the clip with Aaron Russo, that's who it is, talking about CBDCs back in 2009, central bank digital currency, and he's talking about that. We're going to have that up next week, as well as Mark Purdy, just didn't have time for it this week, but we will next week. Mark Purdy on organophosphates. I'm going to chug through those during the spring. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. But before we do, a quickie on the New World Order in New Year's Eve fireworks displays.
There's been a lot of change in these fireworks displays. There's now a lot more technical transhuman themes in them. They use a lot more drones and computerized displays. And we're seeing this in a lot of the New Year's stuff. And so this was at Abu Dhabi this year in the United Arab Emirates. And using that same technical drone display. And so this in Abu Dhabi transformed, and I'll show you the sequence in a moment, but it went into this binary code, you see, ones and zeros, into the matrix. And you saw forming out of the matrix this same type of face, this transhuman AI face coming out of the matrix for this 2023 celebration. So we're going into a lot of these transhuman themes about the rise of the machine. And then in Busan in South Korea, we had the same type of transhuman face with the letters AI displayed in its head. And then behind it, you notice the ones and zeros, the binary code. Now, I don't claim to know how AI or this type of technology may be playing into end times prophecy in the Bible, but it is what it is. You know, it is there and it is growing. And we see this all over the place now. And some people liken it to the image of the beast and all these different things. But I'm just saying that we are in a time where this is beginning to rise up. So in Dubai, again, we have this figure who had the sun rays around its head. And I thank you, Jay, for pointing this out. In Dubai, this, you see, he's got like the Oculus goggles, the virtual reality goggles, and the sun rays around its head in Dubai at the beach. And I want to point out that it is like the Uberman. And this is something I'm going to point out in a video coming to this channel soon, that this is all about that same philosophy of Nietzsche, essentially the Uberman, the Ubermensch, the next stage in human evolution, and how that was also a Nazi pursuit. And after that philosophy of Nietzsche, this new age of enlightenment. Hello, future, it says in Abu Dhabi. And just to point out here, which is pretty interesting, I mean, this shows it's not about the God of Abraham. You see in the center there, you've got Horus, the sun god, the sun deity again. So this is what it's really about. And we saw this similar types of stuff with Saturn and the UFO deception, as shown clearly I think this was in 2020, at the Space Needle in Seattle. So the deception that is rising out of this technological symbolism and displays, and the needle going through manipulating the DNA strand, we saw all of that displayed in 2020. So in Dubai, enter the future, last night.
So that is New Year's Eve Nietzschean World Order from a website. It's a YouTube channel, but it's called rseonline.org. So that's where they are, rseonline.org. Never really come across them before, but fascinating stuff. And quite obviously, I mean, that was recorded actually the day after. That's the 1st of January, the day after that display in London and in Dubai. And he's picking out all sorts of code that's in there, these sigils we were hearing about last week. In relation to the Order of the Nine Angles. I think fascinating stuff. And there's all sorts of other bits and pieces, a more recent one as well on his YouTube channel. Time to sign off, as I said. Thank you to Martin Summers, who's now departed the building. Thanks particularly to Rob and Kate over in Christchurch, New Zealand. Fascinating. And please do, if you can, download and listen to the whole of that, because they've got so much interesting stuff to say about their auntie and the whole nuclear industry. And isn't it brilliant in a way that, he's now based in New Zealand, which is one of the only countries in the world which has a really strict, or certainly part of the Five Eyes or Six Eyes with Israel, the Five Eyes countries and the Western Military Alliance that says no to nuclear weapons still. Thanks also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews, story tips and poems. Poems, yes. Well, I'm going to start getting into doing this every week just before the break, doing some of the poems that you send in and story links, comment page and email addresses. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I've got my books out there, which can wing their way to you. One which is about the history of the secret government from Cromwell to the Princess Diana Association is £20. Martin Bormann, The Traitors of Arnhem and the Bilderbergers, that's £15. And they're actual real books. But there is also a book of my articles, which you can download as an ebook. All of these things via www.bilderberg.org. And Amazon shut me down. They said I was doing identity fraud, so they closed my account, so I couldn't sell it through. Can't sell anything through Amazon anymore. But I can eBay, thank God. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream here. And over Sunday tea time, actually could be Sunday mornings at camberleysradioquk.com. It kind of keeps changing, that one. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and on the Not the Bit BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, talkradio.org.uk, and the app at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Take time, and all through my coffee break time, I say a little prayer for you. Every single day she says everything is free. I used to be so careless, as if I couldn't care less. Did I have to make this mess when I was Mary's dream? Suddenly the heavens roll, suddenly the rain came down, suddenly was washed away. Celebrate. I made such a big mistake when I was Mary's prey. So if I say, save me, be the light in my eyes. If I say, ten hail Marys, leave a light on in heaven for me. Blessed is the one who shares your power and your beauty, Mary. Blessed is the millionaire who shares your wedding day. So when you find somebody you keep, think of me and celebrate. I made such a big mistake when I was Mary's friend. Shake the tree.